welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about New York, well, New York's billionaire mayor. He hath spoken. From his pulpit, he doth promulgate, screw you, unemployed. Vetoed a bill that would have ended discrimination or attempted to end discrimination for the long-term unemployed. And, you know, as you look at this, and I'm sure you've probably seen it too, you see these advertisements, your job ads in the newspaper or online saying, you know what, if you don't have a job, don't bother applying. Which, to me, seems kind of, well, dumb. The reason that we apply for jobs is, well, we're going to talk about that and get your thoughts as well. And, of course, sequester. We'll find out what's in store for us in the coming days, weeks, and months as the petulant party continues with their eyes closed, their ears plugged, and their mouths and gums a-flapping. We'll talk about that. And also, the Marxists are coming. Quick, hide your billions. Another frenzy to blind the working class of the nation. Going to talk about that. Also, more good news on the globalization front. Snakes. Good there. Also, workers in California have stood together, fought back, and after a long, long fight, have won a decent contract. We'll talk to one of those workers tonight. Also, your thoughts, your questions, your comments. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So the austerity, good things. Yes, yes, austerity. Oh, we love it. It works so well. Look at how well it's doing in Europe. In fact, doing so well, downgraded their bond rating. Yay. Also, has it done anything to their debt, to their deficits? No. It's made pain and suffering much worse, which is good because you need to keep those people in line. And once people are struggling and desperate, you have all this sacrifice, they're easier to divide. Because if you're at the margin, and I keep saying, you know, what the wealth class wants is to push us further down that pyramid, the Maslow's hierarchy of need pyramid, and you should take a look at it sometime. The higher up the pyramid you go, the more they want to push you back down, back into that area of making sure that we have shelter and that we're not cold and that we eat. That's where they want to keep us, in that bottom rung. And the easiest way to do that is divide us and keep us pitted at each other's throat by saying, look over there. Look at that person getting food stamps to feed their kids. Don't mind the CEO who, like the guy who runs McDonald's, a million times the hourly wage he takes home. A million times. He would have to work a million hours in one of the restaurants that he oversees to make what he makes as CEO. Kind of mind-blowing. Never mind that. Don't mind the man behind the curtain. And you look at what's going on here in the over in the EU, where they're looking at this coming year going, uh-oh, more contraction, more slowing of the economy, more falling of consumer spending, more falling of business investment, more falling of you know, government spending as well. And understand, that's going to mean higher unemployment. And what does higher unemployment mean? Spiral cycle, more unemployment. As you pull back what we're doing in this country, I look what North Carolina just did, slashed almost in half the weekly benefit, slash the number of weeks that you get it. Why? They want desperation. I know. But, Rick, unemployment is too generous. People will sit there and not take those minimum wage jobs because they'll make more on unemployment than they will at the minimum wage job. And I go, yeah, it's called basic economics. So instead of raising the wage up to get people into those jobs, no, we want to tear down. We want to pull away and understand what that does for the economy. By taking that money out of the economy, it causes more layoffs. It causes more foreclosures. It causes more pain, more suffering, which is good. Love that. It's good. Because then we can pit people against each other. They got something I didn't. You know how often I hear that? That so-and-so got health care. I didn't get health care. And I go, well, why point your finger at them saying they don't deserve? Why don't you, hey, how about me? How do we make sure that everyone gets it? And I had this great conversation last weekend with my very well-to-do uncle. And look, and I've said this before, he's a guy who, in this country, he hit a home run. He started out behind the backstop. He worked his behind off, a couple of really lucky breaks, good salesman, good businessman. And he hit the home run. But he gave me this whole line about, because I had asked, you know, as a matter of public policy, how do we make sure that the people of this, the citizens of this country, have health security? And he looked at me quite blankly and says, they don't deserve it. It's not our job to make sure everyone has health. You go out there and you hustle for yourself. And I go back and as I said, I've been reading this book on how the business class has been selling this idea of the free market to us. You know, competition's good. And I go back to some of the conversations I had when I was down in Florida at Disney World with some of the, and I don't know how I get into these, but somehow I do. Guy from South Carolina lecturing me about lower taxes, lower regulations, and competition. And I had to ask, don't you realize that's a recipe for disaster? That's a recipe for a race to the bottom, because as long as we're desperate, and the more desperate we get, the more we're willing to pollute, the more we're willing to work in unsafe conditions, the lower wages we're willing to work for. Because, hey, you got to put food on the table. Even if you can't keep the mortgage, got to keep the kids fed. And this whole push towards this is a well-scripted, well-funded, well-planned, orchestrated propaganda campaign to get us. How many people go to work and the boss has a meeting? The company has a meeting. They've got a newsletter that comes out. First thing they show you is the stock price. Oh, this is the stock price. And they talk about productivity. Oh, we got to increase productivity. And you go, okay, you know, what we used to do is say we're willing to increase productivity because that's important. Need to have the company profitable. But what about increasing our wealth? What about our share? Oh, no, we're struggling. But then you see the executives and the CEOs and all of this money going out to them. Their check never bounces. They never miss a meal. Your kid misses a meal. And that's where I have a real problem with what we've allowed to happen out from under us. Which is why when yesterday we talked about the Titan International CEO who really just lambasted the people in France, you know, those lazy workers, those so-called workers. Because they've decided in their country, 35 hours is what you should have to work to live. I mean, think about that. I mean, we used to think that way. And as I'm reading through this book, you know, you look at all of the things that the moneyed interests have done over the years to sell their ideology. And to get us to go, we need more competition, When understanding more competition really just means competition on how low you're willing to work. That's where the competition is. It's not about who makes the best widget. If that were the case, I'm all in favor of it. Who can be the most productive? Who can make the best, the highest quality widget? Not who's willing to work for no benefits or no health care, no pension. Who's willing to work for lower. That's not competition in my view. That's devastation. That's destruction. That's ending our standard of living. And that makes no sense. And you look at these trade deals that we've made with other countries around the world. What good has it done you or me or any other working person? Not much. Some got wealthy. The handfuls. We've got the guy who owned the Super Bowl champion Baltimore Ravens. Made his money. My favorite billionaire, by the way, and I'm saying nothing bad about him because, you know, he's probably a very nice guy. But he made his money outsourcing jobs. He's a billionaire because you suffered and you sacrificed and you lost your job. Not because he did it, but because of the laws that we've put people in place to pass. He took advantage of the system. He figured out how to game the system. But we allowed the system to be set up. And I bring it back to this whole sequestering nonsense. And this really is nonsense. I cannot believe that the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world is run in this fashion. on crisis after crisis, you would expect what's gone on the last couple of years to have happened in some banana republic, to happen in some third world Latin American country where they're changing dictators every other week, and you would expect something like that there. But in this nation, where the rest of the world looks, you would think that we would be, or you would hope, that we would at least be able to pave our roads, fund education, invest in our future, so that we say, hey, look at us. But when I see these sequester cuts, and I look at the numbers, what was it, $1.2 trillion in automatic across-the-board budget cuts? You go, what's that going to do to our economic output? What's it going to do to our economy? Well, it's going to do exactly what it did in Europe. It's going to contract our economy. And what does that mean? That means layoffs. That means people are going to lose their homes. That means communities are going to lose their tax base. I mean, I look at Detroit right now. You know, the governor of Michigan said, you know, we were trying to find an emergency manager, but nobody wants the job. Because everybody's left. There's no tax base. And there's no incentive for the state to go in and do anything. And the federal government's not going to do anything because, hey, we can't pay our own bills. Because you've got people who are dead set against raising revenue on any level. So we're allowing communities to crumble. And it's not just Harrisburg or Detroit or Cleveland. It's the entire nation. And I know. We should privatize the roads. And we should privatize everything so that every movement we make is somehow profitable to somebody. Because that's where we're heading. With all of this talk about, well, we need to privatize, and all of this talk of here in Harrisburg of privatizing the liquor stores, privatizing the lottery, and privatizing this or that. And what it means, understand what the right wing of this country wants, what conservative world looks like. It looks like if you don't pay your subscription to the fire company and your house catches on fire, your house burns down. If you don't pay your subscription to the police department, you call because somebody robbed your house, nobody shows up. Conservative world looks at the second you pull out of your driveway, the meter starts running because the private roads you got to pay for. This is what conservative world looks like. And I go down south and you see this in real time. Because this is what they're doing. They're building roads now saying, well, if you don't want to drive on those traffic-jammed roads, we've got a nice toll road for you to go on. Again, going back to that two Americas. And what they sell us is really just twisted and bizarre, and somehow we buy it. I mean, I look at Corbett's pension plan. What he's touting, it's only going to make the situation worse. The only way his plan works, and here's what he's proposing: we're going to stop the defined benefits plan, no more contributing into that. If you're in it, you're going to get what you're guaranteed out of that, and that's it. All new workers are going to this defined contribution plan, and you will have your own little account, and you'll pay into that, and of course the processing fees will come out. And, of course, the banksters will be able to collect that money, and they'll be very happy. And, of course, you'll make bad decisions along the way, and you'll have nothing in there. And if the economy collapses, well, so be it. That's your problem. Here's the problem with his idea. The defined benefit part of this, we still have to pay. The only way his plan would work, because we've seen it happen, we've seen this movie, is if you do what happened in the private sector, which was the private sector was able to steal the workers' pension by bankrupting the companies. They were able to go to bankruptcy judges and say, well, you know, these legacy costs, can you just write those off, please? And gone. And then those pensions went on the backs of who? The taxpayer through the PBGC. There's no PBGC there's no bankruptcy court for our pension fund. They want it. Oh, they would love to screw every worker that's ever worked for the state. All the teachers and the cops and the firefighters, they'd love to stick it to them. Because remember, Republicans love cops and teachers and firefighters, especially cops and firefighters, when it's time to take a picture and put out a photo op. But actually paying for it? Whole different ball of wax. Whole different ball of wax. And, you know, I think about this. If we're going to allow Corbett and the Republicans in this state to do what the private sector has done to you and me, to these this generation of workers, where the government's doing it instead of just some criminal corporations, there's no contract that can't be broken in my view then. And what I'm waiting for is I'm waiting for homeowners to say, sorry, ain't happening. We're not paying our mortgage. Contracts are meaningless. Contracts are meaningless. But here again, these are the people that we put into power. When we come back and talk about some interesting economic news, you know, the recovery, as I've been saying, has happened. Question is did you and I, did we benefit from that recovery? Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to make it anyhow. We want the hell with.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Defense Department has dire warnings for employees waiting for the sequester deadline to fall. Jesse Russell reports.
The Department of Defense issued a warning to civilian employees on Wednesday that as many as 800,000 workers could be put on unpaid leave if budget cuts triggered by the sequester are allowed to move forward in March. Part of the plan being considered by the Pentagon is to put personnel on leave for one day per week for at least 22 weeks. Those employees would see their pay cut by 20% by the unpaid furloughs. Such a loss in pay would not only directly impact the families losing that pay, but also communities with high employment of federal workers. Roughly $1.1 billion would be lost by employees living in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia combined. The sequester would also prevent the renewal of expiring contracts and adoption of new contracts, creating a ripple effect in areas of the private sector that depend on government contracting.
Detroit activist attorney Jerome Goldberg is a founder of Moratorium Now. That's an organization seeking a moratorium on foreclosures to keep working families in their homes. Moratorium Now networks with activists and other organizations around the country pushing for a moratorium. Goldberg says President Obama actually has the authority to declare a moratorium. Goldberg says the federal government now controls most of the mortgages in the U.S. through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA due to government bailouts. As he represents clients facing foreclosures, Goldberg says banks often refuse to work with homeowners on mortgage modifications because it's more profitable for them to throw families out. Banks can often use the government bailout to collect full mortgage values, even on homes that have dropped in value, if they foreclose rather than allow loan modifications.
Why shouldn't the federal government, instead of using tax dollars to toss people out in the street, put a moratorium on foreclosures? And we believe that President Obama, through an executive order, can do just that.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Thursday released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chamber say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you look at when it came to the Wall Street bailouts, did the President of the United States listen to you when it came to bailing out the big banks?
What is wrong with you? Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Funny. Randall writes, America is one big hustle. He says, have you ever noticed that most salesmen are conservatives? What do they produce? Selling you stuff you don't need. And stuff that it is. It's really a big hustle. I mean, you go back to Reaganomics. You go back to that whole, it was really a great PR scheme. It was really, what we want to be able to do. Look, I would love nothing more than to be able to puff out my chest and thump my chest and say, oh, I'm number one. I'm the greatest. We do everything the best, and we're the most innovative, and we're the most creative, and we're the most caring, and the most giving, and the most all of that. I would love to say that. But I look at too many neighborhoods in this country, not even anywhere else. I look at too much of what's going on here. And I go, you know, we're not number one. And if this is what number one looks like, we should be striving for more. And it's not because, like Rush Limbaugh, I'm ashamed of my country. I'm not. I love my country like anybody else. And I'm one of those people, I'll punch you in the mouth if you tell me otherwise. Because that's the era I grew up. You punch somebody in the mouth nowadays, geez, you know, it's a federal crime. And I think we'd be a lot better off if we did every once in a while when somebody cocked off, you pop them in the mouth. I think it'd stop some shootings maybe. Or it may create some more, but we'll have more gun news later. I look at this sales angle, this big hustle. We've been sold this bill of goods that somehow trickle-down economics is good for us. If we give the wealthy more, they'll create jobs. If we give the money to people who know how to use it, they'll use it to benefit society, which is nonsensical on so many levels. Because they do know what to do with money. And they do know how to use that to benefit themselves, not so much society. And this idea that more goods and more services somehow makes us better, I disagree with. You know, you look at the numbers. We're working harder and longer for less. The working people of this country have fallen back precipitously every year, year after year. And, you know, you don't have to make this stuff up. There's plenty of research out there. And as I've been saying since the end of the recession, if you believe it ever ended, because for most people, it hasn't ended. And for a lot of folks, they're still in a depression because they haven't found jobs. They haven't found the wages that they once had. And, you know, the bills don't go down. My mortgage didn't go down. My utilities sure as heck haven't gone down. Food prices haven't come down, but wages have. And you look at where the wages have gone, well, to the very top. You look at the top 1% who have enjoyed very very good growth in income over the last year. In fact, since the end of the recession, they've seen their income grow 11%, over 11%. Do you know what the rest of us have done? So the 1% saw over 11% increase in their income. Do you know what you and me and everyone else saw? A decline of 0.4%. So when they say since the end of since 2009, when they say the recession ended, all of that new income growth, all of that income, 121% went to the top 1%. That means the rest of us, well, we got screwed, right? Absolutely. And they pointed out that in 2011, the top 10%, that heavy 10, took almost 47% of all the income in the country. That's the highest proportion of the income to that group since 1917. And what that doesn't include, that's income. That's what we based as, you know, you worked for that income. It's what comes in a paycheck. It's not investments. No. It's not the gambling. It's not the dividends. Not that stuff. No, it's your earnings. It's what you're paying federal tax on earnings on wages on income. Not the investments. No. Investments are sacrosanct. When the reality is half this country, and this is what blows my mind, half the country is in that low income range or living in poverty. So when Mitt Romney's talking about, oh, the 47% of those people who don't pay any federal taxes, those are working people. Those are people who, they don't make enough money to pay federal tax. They sure pay a whole lot of other taxes, though, but not the federal one. And again, what you've seen is those people, the 47%, their wages have actually gone backwards and at a much higher percent than the 0.4% decline of the 99%. And what blows my mind, and I guess this is one of those things that just leaves me scratching my head. You look at the states that are doing the worst, the states that have the highest poverty rates, the states who have the highest childhood poverty rates, the highest food stamp rates, and they're mostly states in the South and in the West, because they've got the highest proportion of low-income families. You look at Arizona, New Mexico, South Carolina, and what are their politicians, what are their Tea Party people doing? Well, we need to shred that safety net. We need to destroy that. Because you're going to get those people desperate enough, they take those minimum wage jobs. And, of course, they're against raising the minimum wage as well. It's just mind-boggling. And those same people who, wow, we want to cut food stamps. I remember a couple years ago I took the food stamp challenge. And I encourage people to try it. I mean, because, you know, just try it for a week. Because it's really eye-opening. When you sit down and I'm not even saying do it for a month, because the average SNAP benefit, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that benefit, what they call, what food stamps is about $133 a month. Something less than a buck and a half per person per meal. So try and live on because when I did it was $3 a day. Try living on $4 a day. It's really very difficult to do. But here you've got these politicians, you've got these Tea Party types going, well, you get out there and work for a living. And it just leaves me scratching my head. Because you look at the poverty that we've got in this country, and there's a real problem. And you look at how we measure poverty. If we measured poverty like most other countries in the world, which is 50% of the median income, we'd have a quarter of seniors. A quarter. Living in poverty. We have our own calculation, so it's much less than that. But if we use what the rest of the world does, we'd have a problem. And I go, you know, I hear the people tell me, well, you know, Rick, we're broke. We don't have the money to help those people. We don't have it. Sorry. And I go, we've got plenty of money. We're the richest country in the world, aren't we? It's our priorities are screwed up. You look at the fact that we are the largest incarcerator in the world. We lock more people up than anybody in the entire world. We've got less than 5% of the world's population, yet we lock up 25% of the world's prison population. So by any stretch, and you think about how much money we've spent, something like $64 billion, $64 billion a year on locking people up. Now, I'm not saying that some people don't deserve to be locked up, but there are some pretty dumb things we lock people up for. Because it's profitable. Well, we could take that $64 billion and hire cops or hire teachers, invest in education. You know, there's a lot of priorities we could maybe send kids to college. Because we know you send someone to college, they're going to do better in the job market. I mean, you look at the latest unemployment numbers. College graduates have the lowest unemployment rate, have a higher income rate. Only makes sense, right? You know, someone with a bachelor's degree, according to the Association of State Higher Education Executives, the executive officers say, you know, if you have the median income for someone with a bachelor's degree, it's $50,000. You got a high school diploma, it's about $29,000. The more education you have, the higher up. If you had an associate's degree, you're talking about 38 grand. Any graduate degree, a master's degree, you're in the 68,000 range. You want to talk about high school dropouts? They're living in poverty. It's just what it is. And what's going on is we have seen the wealth of this country looted right out from under our feet. It's been stolen away from us. And I go back to that study done by Emmanuel Saez that pointed out 121% of the recovery went to the top 1%. And I look at what Joseph Stiglitz, the number he came up with, and this is huge, where the top 1% hold a quarter of our nation's wealth. And there are some, like my uncle, who says, well, you know, that's because we know what to do with it. And we had this conversation about his house, and he lives in a beautiful house. 15 bedrooms, 10 bathrooms, this massive house. And he looked me point blank and said, not everyone could live in this house. And I shot back, not everyone wants to. Because he's right. Not everybody can keep a house like that clean. Who's got the time? You got to work. Not everyone could maintain it. Not everyone could pay the electric bill or the heating bill. He's right. And that's not what we want. And I find it interesting that the very wealthy see me pointing out that they control a quarter of the nation's wealth. This small number of people control a quarter, a large chunk of our wealth. They think that, well, you're class war. You want everyone to be equal, and I must have heard that 100 times. You want everyone to be equal, and we're never going to be equal. I just want somebody who works for a living to be able to exist. I want people who punch the clock, who work their behind off, and play by the rules and do the right thing. I want them to be able to survive. The sad reality is the people who play by the rules, because we're sold that line of BS quite often. I play by the rules. The people who don't play by the rules are the ones who do quite well. And all I have to do is point to Wall Street and go, look what they did. Look what they did to our economy. Look what they did to this nation. Look at how many people's lives were shattered because of their gimmicks and their scheming and their greed and their selfishness. You know, the guy we talked to last night, and it's an interview that everyone should hear. You go to the ricksmithshow.com, there's the podcast there. Steve Bailey was his name. If you got the Stitcher app, get the Stitcher app. It's there as well. They stole his house from him. The guy was making payments every month. He did what they told him to do. He was playing by the rules. And they kicked him to the curb. They stole his house and made him look like a liar to his child. And there's nothing he can do about it. None of those people are going to be held to account. There's something wrong with that. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
With all the woes that we humans have inflicted on our weary old Earth, from the reckless plundering of her resources to the self-destructive tampering with her climate, perhaps it's time we give her a break. What, you want us to cut back on our fracking, ransacking, scorched earth ways? No, no, of course not. I merely mean that the good earth is getting a bit, shall we say, depleted. So, to maintain our insatiable appetite for devouring our own environment, shouldn't we be seeking greener pastures to exploit? Good news, our scientists are already on top of it. At the 221st annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in January, all the buzz was about drastically ramping up the flow of tax dollars into sky surveys to detect and analyze, quote, near-Earth asteroids. It seems that some 20,000 of these hulking chunks of rock, ice, and who knows what are orbiting around our solar system, yet only 6,000 of them have been identified. The professional sky watchers say that at the current pace of detecting and probing this plethora of asteroids zipping around and at us, not only are we in grave danger of being smacked by some, but we're also missing one heck of an economic opportunity, for there's gold in them thar skies. With dollars in their eyes, several astronomers predict that many asteroids contain rich veins of platinum, cobalt, zinc, and other valuable metals, as well as such essential human needs as oxygen and hydrogen. Let's go get it, is their exuberant cry. First, they demand, fund us and our technological probes to find out what's in each chunk of space stuff, then finance manned missions to harvest the goodies. This is Jim Hightower saying, how fracking wonderful is this? Our expertise at exploitation of natural resources need not be earthbound. We have it within us to mess up the whole cosmos.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends Investor Class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Just run, run! The Marxists are coming! The Marxists are coming! It's the end. The Marxists are taking over. And I've heard this. This has been the Glenn Beck theme. And the way out extreme right wing. The Marxists are taking over because they want everyone to be completely equal. And you've got a senator from Texas, the newly elected Republican Ted Cruz, who, you know, along the same lines of the McCarthy, the communists are everywhere. They've infiltrated the State Department. Well, according to Cruz, he believes those communists left the State Department, went to work at Harvard. They are the Harvard professors because, you know, Obama was a Harvard guy. He attended there. And you just kind of scratch your head and go, okay, you know, I don't know that I would really want to live in a world where paranoia was all around me. But here you go again. It's about separating people. You know, because you hear socialist, you hear communist, and people automatically get defensive. They get, well, don't call me that. And that's the reason they keep throwing it out there, to divide us, to separate us. And I've heard it 1,000 times. Obama's a socialist. I've also heard he's a communist and a fascist. So you kind of go, well, first, I guess you got to have your definitions right. But have you seen what's gone on? I don't necessarily agree that what Obama is doing is anything near, even in the same ballpark as socialism. The health care plan, while I think a step in the right direction, nowhere near socialism. Maybe the only component that you could maybe possibly make an argument for is making sure that everyone can get coverage. But he does it in a very business-friendly way. And if you listen to the State of the Union address, you heard a lot of stuff in there that should have made the Republicans do backflips, should have made the right-wing think tanks ask for more money because it's working. they have succeeded in moving the Democratic Party to the extreme right, to what used to be the extreme right, as the right wing continues to go to the further extreme. A lot of what I heard was more privatization, more globalization, more corporatization. And, you know, it just, it leaves me, he did talk about universal kindergarten, though. Universal pre-K programs, universal Head Start, that kind of stuff. Something, understand, the sequester is going to really hurt. Because if this sequester happens, you know, some programs that are fairly crucial to education, some of the funding from the No Child Left Behind, which I'm not overly thrilled with the law, but there is funding in that. Some of the Head Start programs, some of the programs for people with disabilities, screwed. Because it's going to make massive cuts. In fact, one of the cuts I saw, $725 million from the Title I funding, which would affect something like 2,700 schools, 1.2 million students, and, of course, those jobs, you know, those teachers and the support staff, almost 10,000 of those at risk. And you go, well, yeah, those aren't real jobs, teaching our kids, taking care of our most precious commodities. No, those aren't real jobs. No. Thanks to the Head Start, the cuts to Head Start cost about 70,000 children the ability to go to Head Start and all of the jobs that would come with it. The Disabilities Act, you would see a reduction of about $579 million. So you're looking at this, you're going, 1.2 million children. 2,700 schools, you add it up, some 30,000 teachers, support staff. Can we afford that? And you look at what's going on, and there have been a number of studies, and to me, this is more dividing America. Because those are programs that are generally used by the 47% of people who don't pay federal income tax, the working poor. And if you look at the studies that have been out there, there is a direct correlation between income and student achievement because programs like these are so poorly underfunded. And that opportunity to get to the next level, that opportunity to, and sure, there's one, there's always going to be one, but for the majority. And it just, it leaves me angry. It leaves me frustrated. And I'm hoping at some point we see a movement of people saying enough. Enough with the school closings, moving a school from a safe neighborhood into one of the most dangerous neighborhoods there in Philadelphia. Enough of the voucherizing, charterizing, profitizing education. Enough of it already. Educating the next generation shouldn't be about how much money we can put into our pocket. What do we get from the Republicans? Wow. Free markets. When Obama talked about preschool programs. You got Marsha Blackburn, the Republican representative from Tennessee, was on Washington Journal on C-SPAN right after. Said, wow, it's just going to be too much paperwork. It's just way too much paperwork. We can't have the paperwork. Sorry, it is what it is. And then you've got this Fox woman who just, you know, again, you know, who puts these people on TV? This Jerry Willis is her name, on Fox Business, saying,
I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it. To say preschool for everybody, are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that.
Yeah, we don't have the money for that. It's crazy talk. Crazy talk. Even though the studies have been done. You put money into early childhood education, it reaps massive benefits over that child's life. But we don't care about those people. Come on, those are the people who don't pay federal income tax. And we can't afford it. Yet Stanford University just raised $1 billion in a single year. You figure it out. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes, and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25, plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
After a large meteor exploded over Russia in February 2013, many were comparing the event to one that also happened in Russia a century before.
That earlier event happened on June 30, 1908, in a remote part of Russia. As in 2013, witnesses saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky. Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. Explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia. It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations of the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of the Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30, 1908. As in 2013, the object appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above Russia. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org. Earth Sky.
After a large meeting,
we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Yes, binders. Love that song. That's a shame. Had he won, we could have kept using that, but not so much anymore. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Good news. Globalization has brought a new product to Guam. Yes, millions of snakes. Brown tree snakes, in fact. And these brown tree snakes, what have they done? They've pretty much eaten all of the birds on the island. The claims are there are only a couple hundred birds left. They're now on the endangered list. But you've got all of these snakes. And spiders. Because evidently, birds eat spiders. So once you take all the birds away, now you have 40 times more spider webs on Guam than on any of the other nearby islands. And, well, not real good for tourism, snakes and spiders. I don't know that you're going to get a lot of honeymooning couples to go there. So the U.S. government has come up with a great idea. They're going to drop drugged, dead mice all over the island with little parachutes. And, you know, when I read this story, I'm going, that's kind of ludicrous. But if you think about it, you know, the way they rolled it out, they're going to drop the little mice who have been drugged out of the planes with little parachutes. And the parachutes are supposed to get stuck in the trees. And while in the trees, where the snakes live, the snakes will feast upon the drugged mouse or mice, and they will die. I don't know. Millions and millions of snakes. How'd this happen? Oh, yeah, globalization. The boats come in, the boats go out. Tourists come in, they come out. Goods come in nice little crates, they come out. And you go, well, gee, that would never happen here, would it? Have you seen those little armor-shelled looking bugs? They call them stink bugs. Have you seen those? First came in a box somewhere into the Allentown area, is what they're saying. And now they're in 33 states, and they're going to infest the entire nation because, well, there is no natural predator here in this country for it. And I think of, you know, this kind of thing. I guess they're going to use, you know, the dead mice with little parachutes, so at least you're not going to have a mouse problem, right? You know, the mice won't overrun the island because they'll already be dead, so I kind of understand that. But I think about, you know, where I grew up in Cleveland with the dead lake. They decided, well, you know, we need to clean up the lake. The water's polluted. Nothing lives here. So we need to introduce something into the ecosystem to help clean up the water. And they came up with zebra mussels. Yes, we'll bring zebra mussels in and they will clean. They will filtrate the water and it will be good. And after a couple of years, it did that. It was wonderful. Worked very well. The lake has life now. There are actually fish in Lake Erie. I never thought it was possible, but it is. Because when I was a kid, you couldn't go swimming in Lake Erie. Everything was brown, and the fish that were there were floating sideways, looking at you with one dead eye. And the beaches, because there were a couple of beaches there with big posted signs, do not swim. Because we had allowed corporations to pollute at will. In fact, you know, in the 50s, the Cuyahoga River, which goes into Lake Erie, actually caught on fire. Because, and it could have happened anywhere. It could have happened, you know, to the Lehigh River. It could have happened to the Susquehanna, I'm sure. It could have happened anywhere where industry was spewing into the waterway. And the steel mills down there were spewing just all kinds of whatever they wanted. And it caught on fire. And burned for a little while. And Cleveland became a joke because they've got the burning river. It was big industry. So I look at this globalization, and again, the zebra mussels did a great job. But the problem is, now the water intake pipes out, you know, into the lake, they're all plugged with zebra mussels. If you own a boat, good luck on that one, because they're everywhere. Because they have no natural predator. And then there's talk, well, let's introduce a predator for them. Well, who's going to? This is what happens when you screw around with ecosystems. But, you know, here we go. The Rex Tillersons of the world, the CEO of ExxonMobil, we can engineer our way out of it. So the latest engineering idea, dead mice drugged with little parachutes. It's beautiful. So I keep wondering, what are they going to do with the stink bugs? Because I hate those damn things. They're everywhere. And they're only going to get worse, because here again, thank you globalization, thank you trade with Asia, we now have this problem. But I know, we can engineer our way out of it. There was a fish someone told me about, I think it was somewhere, one of the offshoots of the Mississippi River, where they have this fish that actually walks. It's like a dogfish or something, where it actually goes and kills things on land. I mean, it has no natural predators and is destroying everything. But I guess we'll figure that out too, right? Man, what we do to ourselves. And that's what gets me. I mean, it's the things that we do to ourselves that we allow to happen around us. All in the name of, well, I need another buck. Which is why I keep saying we need to, more than anything, we need to come together, we need to stand up, we need to organize. Which is why I think it's a great idea to come out to the Keystone Progress Pennsylvania Progressive Summit 2013. Fighting back, moving forward is the slogan. It's the first and the second at the Harrisburg Hilton. You can go to keystoneprogress.org to get to the website to sign up. It's extremely reasonable. Going to have some very interesting speakers. One of the guys that I'm looking forward to hopefully interviewing and hearing speak is this guy David Cobb, who is the national spokesman for Move to Amend. Something that I've been saying for years. Corporations are not people. They should not have the same free speech rights. They should not have the same rights as you and me and living, breathing human beings. Sorry, not the way the Constitution meant it. This was an abomination of law. This was a footnote in a case from the 1800s. Should not be the law of the land. So it'll be interesting to hear from him and to get to talk to him. Also, the three Democratic Party victors in the last election who won the Roar offices, Kathleen Kane, the Attorney General. It'll be interesting to hear from her, especially with the lottery privatization she shot down. Auditor General Eugene D. Pasquale is going to be there, and Treasurer Rob McCord. Also, some national folks, Congressman Raul Grijalva from Arizona, Jim Dean, the chair of Democracy for America, and a whole slew of other folks. I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be an interesting opportunity to do the networking I think we need to do. Because you look at all of these things that are going on, the low wages, the benefits going away, all of this globalization, all of these, it's all part of no rights at work agenda that the right keeps throwing at us. And we've got to come together and we got to fight and say no more. The distribution of wealth that has gone on in this country, and I love hearing my Tea Party friends say, well, Rick, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. You bet your sweet bippy I am. Because it's been taken, it hasn't just been taken, it's been stolen from the working people of this country. And it's about time that we stand up and we say, we're going to take it back. We created you. We can uncreate you. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. If you've got the Stitcher app on your smartphone, you can get it there as well. Questions, any comments, something, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, back with hour three of the program. Stick around.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Defense Department has dire warnings for employees waiting for the sequester deadline to fall. Jesse Russell reports.
The Department of Defense issued a warning to civilian employees on Wednesday that as many as 800,000 workers could be put on unpaid leave if budget cuts triggered by the sequester are allowed to move forward in March. Part of the plan being considered by the Pentagon is to put personnel on leave for one day per week for at least 22 weeks. Those employees would see their pay cut by 20% by the unpaid furloughs. Such a loss in pay would not only directly impact the families losing that pay, but also communities with high employment of federal workers. Roughly $1.1 billion would be lost by employees living in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia combined. The sequester would also prevent the renewal of expiring contracts and adoption of new contracts, creating a ripple effect in areas of the private sector that depend on government contracting.
Detroit activist attorney Jerome Goldberg is a founder of Moratorium Now. That's an organization seeking a moratorium on foreclosures to keep working families in their homes. Moratorium Now networks with activists and other organizations around the country pushing for a moratorium. Goldberg says President Obama actually has the authority to declare a moratorium. Goldberg says the federal government now controls most of the mortgages in the U.S. through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA due to government bailouts. As he represents clients facing foreclosures, Goldberg says banks often refuse to work with homeowners on mortgage modifications because it's more profitable for them to throw families out. Banks can often use the government bailout to collect full mortgage values, even on homes that have dropped in value, if they foreclose rather than allow loan modifications.
Why shouldn't the federal government, instead of using tax dollars to toss people out in the street, put a moratorium on foreclosures? And we believe that President Obama, through an executive order, can do just that.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Thursday released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chambers say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We imagine a pink unicorn. If you had a pink unicorn, how many dollars in taxes would you raise to trade for the pink unicorn? Since pink unicorns do not exist in the real world, it has never occurred to me to worry about the from South Carolina. He's not going to vote for a deal because the kind of 10-to-1 ratio deal he's talking about with real ironclad spending cuts is never going to happen.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So hold on to your hats. The end of the world is coming, or at least, you know, the end of our defense, or the end of, however the latest crisis is being spun to us. You look at fake news at Fox, and boy, just graphic after graphic of doomsday and slash and burn. And you go, how did we get here? We chose to be here. How do we undo this? Well, we can easily choose to undo it. The question is can we and will they? Our folks in Washington, D.C. And Anna Chu, she's the policy director over at Think Progress's War Room at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. She's written a piece, The Impact of the Sequester on Communities Across America, which is why I've asked Anna to come talk to us. Anna, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much, Rick. You know, I'm happy to be here, and I'm actually sorry to be here, though, at the same time, because we're talking about such a serious, devastating crisis that's about to hit.
I look at this, and what blows my mind is we're wasting all of this time on crisis after manufactured crisis after manufactured crisis when we should be getting people back to work. We should be creating jobs and getting the economy moving forward. We've got a party in this country hell-bent on MAD, back to the 80s, mutual assured destruction.
I agree. I agree. The economy is still struggling. People and families are still struggling. But what's happening in Congress is they're not recognizing what is happening in everyday communities. And instead, they're just arguing and fighting. And you see these conservative leaders in Congress that are refusing to talk about a sensible way to balance the deficit, but instead, what they want to do is they want to hold the economy hostage, and they want to force these devastating across-the-board spending cuts. I mean, we are talking about people like Paul Ryan, like John Boehner, who admit that these across-the-board spending cuts of about $1.2 trillion will be devastating to our economy. And they know that it's going to be hurtful. They know it's going to be harmful. But at the same time, they have been saying that they are welcoming it, that they want this to happen, even though it's painful.
And which makes absolutely no sense to me, because I mean, if you agree that a recovery has happened, and I mean, we've seen statistics of the last several months that have shown that a recovery happened. The sad reality is the vast majority of Americans, especially working class Americans, didn't see the recovery, and in fact actually fell backwards as the recovery went to the very wealthy in this country. But what's amazing to me is all of these manufactured crises, all of this stuff, spent when we should be, like I said, creating jobs, infrastructure here in Harrisburg, the sinkhole capital of the world, in my view, 41 sinkholes in the last year. I don't see anybody rushing to fix that. All we're doing is creating more sinkholes, more traps, more destruction. It's mindless to me, and there's part of me that goes, we should be throwing all of those people out of D.C. and getting people in there who are going to say, you know what? We absolutely need visionary leaders, not petulant children.
Mm-hmm. I think the question here is, what are the priorities of the leaders, you know, on both sides of the tables? Like, why are we not filling those sinkholes? Who are you protecting instead of filling those sinkholes and instead of protecting the families? I mean, what's been happening is we've had a long, protracted debate about how do we reduce our deficit? How do we address the deficit that's been occurred that folks, you know, like Bush, President Bush, have caused to rise up with two unpaid-for wars. So how do we address this? We have President Obama who's come forth with a balanced approach time and again, you know, talking about both spending cuts and new revenue by closing tax loopholes, like, you know, sensible, common measure ways that we can take to address the deficit. But we see the Republicans saying no to this type of balanced, smart approach. They instead are saying that, yes, let's have these painful across-the-board spending cuts so that we don't have to close the wasteful tax loopholes that folks like Mitt Romney use every day and the folks like Big Oil use every day.
So let me ask you, you know, a lot of people are going, you know, because the way they make this seem is that it's inevitable. This is, you know, we're this crisis is looming. There's this I hear a natural disaster. There's nothing natural about the disaster that's coming, in my view. How do we get to this point?
You know, you're absolutely right, Rick. This is not a natural disaster. I mean, this has been in the works for almost 2 years now. What really happened was it started in 2001 when the time came to raise the debt ceiling. Now, the debt ceiling, raising the debt ceiling had nothing to do with increasing spending, but it really was just about paying off the bills that we already incurred, that, you know, it was money that we already spent and we just need to figure out a way to pay for it. So what happened then was Speaker Boehner and his, you know, conservative cohorts in Congress said, no, I'm not going to raise the debt ceiling. I'm not going to pay off the nation's bill. Instead, we'll only do this if you agree to take a massive axe to federal spending across the board. And so we had this huge debacle in the summer of 2011. And what happened was we got so close to the debt ceiling limit, to the time when it came, you know, when we really had to vote to raise it. And you had credit associations downgrading the nation because Congress couldn't get its act together.
And, you know, the thing is when you're talking about the most powerful nation on earth, the most economically powerful, defense-wise most powerful, if the rest of the world is looking at us and going, look, they can't get their act together, what message is that sending around the world? And I go back and I think during the Bush years, as much as the Democrats, you know, would raise the flag, they still increased the debt limit 19 times and not one hostage crisis.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of things going on. I mean, first, you know, I do admit democracy can be messy sometimes. Not everyone's going to agree. We understand that. We get that. But it also sends a really bad message, and it's also shameful that you have some folks who are just so entrenched and so unwilling to listen to the other side and listen to, you know, other ways to approach the situation and to fix the situation, that they're willing to go to such extremes. I mean, we don't do this when we think about, you know, how we do our foreign relations, and why are we doing this with each other, with our own credit, with our own economy? Makes no sense.
It makes no sense. This whole situation, none of these crises have made any sense to me because, you know, it's like the fiscal cliff, or as I called it, the fiscal mirage, because they just made it up. And as easily as they make this stuff up, as easily as they pull it out of whole cloth and make this, they can undo it. I mean, this sequester is not, what's going to happen in a couple of days is not inevitable. I mean, there is a way of stopping this. It's just they're choosing not to. And, you know, I look at on the local level, you know, how many social programs are going to be, as you pointed out, with an axe cut? How many education programs, how many programs that people need every day? How much pain and suffering is going to cause average everyday working people because they're, well, petulant?
Rick, it's honestly, sadly, too much to count or too many to count. I mean, Pennsylvania is looking at about $250 million in cuts in this year alone. I mean, this means everything from taking away money to pay for cops, money to pay for firefighters, you know, money to pay for the teachers, for the schools to keep them only, to keep them open, to parks. I mean, we just saw today that six airports in Pennsylvania could be closed because of the sequester. And that's an airport in Harrisburg itself. So we're talking about Capital City Airport in Harrisburg that may be cut because of the sequester. So, you know, we've already heard, you know, folks from the administration say to expect long lines when you wait, when you go to the airport, to expect TSA to take longer and longer and longer than it already is. But even beyond that, we're just looking at airports shutting down.
Yeah. So let me ask you then, you know, and because I'm a firm believer, and this is all by design, this is all the grand extreme Republican plan. I mean, there's some rational Republicans left, at least I hope, but this is the extreme, the people who don't believe in government, don't want government doing anything, and whatever they can do to make government look bad, ineffective, slow, cumbersome, whatever words you want to use, they're going to do. And by doing what they're doing, by playing this card, it only plays into their hands because, as you pointed out, TSA is going to take longer. The airports are going to be closed down. Our roads are crumbling under our feet. So you've got the perfect talking point for the right wing, the extremists of the right wing saying, you know, hey, government doesn't work. And we've put these people into power to show us that the way they run government doesn't work, only we don't make that distinction.
You know, I think this is going to backfire.
I hope so.
Because I think what's going to happen is we are going to see how you can't go to Harrisburg Airport anymore. You can't go to Williamsport Airport anymore. You can't go to Lancaster Airport anymore. You can't go to, you know, there's maybe possible parks will be closed. We're talking about schools and teachers being laid off. People will see firsthand what government actually does for them. I mean, we're not just talking about potholes in your neighborhood street, you know, the 41 potholes that might not be fixed, but we're talking about courthouses possibly, you know, shutting down for however many days of the week. We're talking about, you know, 31,000 people less in Pennsylvania that will get employment services. I mean, we're still recovering from the recession. Why are we cutting things like employment services that help people get jobs again?
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you know, because I'm a firm believer of if people don't really take action or don't really get involved until it affects them directly. Might what you've just laid out that not be a good thing to get people activated, to get them engaged, to say, well, I never realized that, you know, this is part of it, and maybe pointing the finger in the right direction saying, look, it's these people with their fingers in their ears on their backs kicking and screaming on the ground that have caused this.
You know, Rick, you know, I hate to be, you know, callous towards all the American families that might be suffering and all the students that might not be able to go to school and all the businesses that can't even travel and say that this is, you know, good for anyone. Because this will be really terrible and disastrous for so many communities. But what I do hope is that it will, you know, force those conservative leaders in Congress to come to the table and finally realize that we do need a balanced approach, that you cannot balance the deficit entirely on the middle-class families, that you do have to find a way to cut wasteful spending and cut wasteful tax breaks and tax loopholes, you know, for the big oil, for millionaires who are already making out great. And that's what my hope is. My hope is that this will cause people to realize we need a balanced approach.
I'm with you. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I've said, I think it only when it hits home do people really then sit up and take notice. Because what I think's happened over the last couple of years is Most people, they just want the pain to stop. They want the constant bickering. They want the constant this crisis, the next crisis, the next crisis. And there's a couple more set to come. They just want it to stop. They want to be able to raise their families and you know, live their lives without all of this constant barrage of, you know, what's coming out of D.C., this, that nothing can get done. And I think, and I go back to my premise that, you know, the people on the extreme right, and I don't buy the conservative argument anymore. It's not conservatives that are ruining the country. It's these extremists who are calling themselves conservatives, who are ruining this country. You know, I look at this and I go, it's playing right into their hands of saying, look, government doesn't work, and we're going to make sure that you know it doesn't work.
You know, I think the American people will catch on to them. And I think they will realize that it's not that the government doesn't work. It's that they are making the government not work, that they are bankrupting the government, that they are really going into these communities, and this is what they're doing to our communities. They're cutting meat inspectors, you know, who do food inspection. And they're the ones jeopardizing the very food coming to our table. I think the American people will realize what the extremists are doing. And when they do, I hope that they will shout out and push back against what these extremists are doing.
Yeah, and like I said, I think it only matters. It only when it comes home and you realize that, hey, this is what's happened. And I'm hoping, you know, I go back and I look at what happened in the 90s when the Republicans shut down government, and people woke up and said, well, wait a second, that's important to us. And I'm hoping that we go back to that. People start saying, you know, as the city here in Harrisburg is crumbling, people look to government and say, look, you need to fix this, because what we've been fed, this whole idea that, well, we're going to privatize and profitize everything, it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked, and it's not going to work.
I agree. I agree with you. I think the people will wake up, that they will realize that government has an important role in society, has an important role in the community, and it's not the big bad villain that the extremists are painting it out to be. And I'm hopeful that people, you know, will realize this. They'll send a clear message to those extremists in Congress, and it'll force them to come to the table and negotiate and find a balanced solution.
Do you think anything is going to come? Do you think there's a way of stopping this, or is this going to happen?
You know, I will always be an optimist at heart, and I will always hope that when Congress comes back next week, you know, they'll get together and maybe, you know, there will be some compromise. You know, we do know that the Senate is going to consider alternative ways to attack this, you know, to get rid of the sequester, to find a balanced common sense approach, you know, that Americans pay on, like, let's close wasteful tax loopholes and have targeted smart cuts, not just cuts to education and cuts to our airports, but let's be smart about this. So I will always still be hopeful. But, you know, Rick, we've seen reports and we've seen statements from Republican leaders that are saying that they want the sequester to come, that they want these things to happen. So that troubles me.
Yeah,
it really troubles me.
I mean, it troubles me that you've got them coming out saying, you know, we're ready to pursue scorched earth. I mean, we've known that all along, that this is the party of scorched earth. But this is just, to me, them showing their hand. And I tell my Republican listeners, especially my Tea Party friends, the extremists have taken the Republican Party. Please get involved in your party and take them back to some reason of insanity. This is not the party of Eisenhower, who built the interstate highway system. This is not the party of Lincoln. This is not the party even of Ronald Reagan. This is the party of extremists and radicals.
You know, their party absolutely has been changing the last couple of years. And you do see, you know, we have seen that extremist element get stronger and stronger and stronger.
Because of the money.
You know,
because of the money. I mean, you look at the billionaires who are funding these campaigns and all of this money that's gone into the political system. I mean, we were basically, there's a party in this country who's beholden to the smallest portion of the 1%.
think money is definitely a problem, especially when the Supreme Court overturned Citizens United and just opened the floodgates for secret spending and secret money and more money from folks like Koch's brother, you know, and millionaires from Nevada deciding that they want to put in millions of dollars into states like Ohio or Florida because they can't. There's something wrong with that system wherein you can have these wealthy, wealthy, wealthy individuals decide that they want to do it, they want to play politics, and they want to influence the elections, and they want to do it in secret.
Last line of questioning. You brought up the billionaires, and you went with it. You know, I don't see how the sequester helps them. I mean, I don't see how pulling, you know, billions of dollars from defense spending, I don't see pulling billions of dollars from public health programs and education and any of these things. I don't see how constricting our economy and austerity is going to help them. I know it's going to harm me and working people like me, but I don't see how it's going to help them either.
You know, I think there is a conflict there. I think you do have, you know, some sensible folks amongst them, and I'm not going to say all millionaires are not unsensible and just say millionaires are bad in general. You know, you have some sensible folks who are considerate and who are thoughtful about how this would affect the economy and what this will do to their companies, really, when you tank the economy like this. But then you also have folks who are very concerned about the wasteful tax loopholes that they've been keeping.
Yeah.
And that they've enjoyed for years and years and years. When our economy was good, nobody thought about it. But, you know, what happened with the economy when it went down was people started to be very, very concerned and looking around and thinking about how to address the deficit.
Yeah, and I'm all in favor of taking billions away from oil companies before we even consider taking food out of the mouths of children. Sorry, just not going there. And I'm not going to cut food stamp programs while we're still handing out billions to oil companies. It's just not going to happen in my opinion.
Agree. This is about priorities. This is about where we stand and who we're protecting. And we have to be on the side of the middle class.
Yep. And if this sequester is allowed to happen, if the Republicans are the ones who push this to the mat, I saw a report some 700,000 jobs could be lost over the next year. Our economy could shrink by almost 1%, 0.6% over the next year. That is not a way to run a country, in my view.
No. 750,000 jobs lost right now would be devastating. It would be devastating for the people of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
We're talking, you know, we're talking layoffs across the board, layoffs, cuts to families, cuts to dinner tables. You know, this is not the approach that we need to
lose on infinitum. There's no win here, at least not for people. Anna, I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate the article. Again, the article, The Impact of the Sequester on Communities Across America. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Anna Chu's name. It'll take you right there. Anna, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thank you.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Or was it a shell game from the master of the folk and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
With all the woes that we humans have inflicted on our weary old Earth, from the reckless plundering of her resources to the self-destructive tampering with her climate, perhaps it's time we give her a break. What, you want us to cut back on our fracking, ransacking, scorched Earth ways? No, of course not. I merely mean that the good Earth is getting a bit, shall we say, depleted. So, to maintain our insatiable appetite for devouring our own environment, shouldn't we be seeking greener pastures to exploit? Good news, our scientists are already on top of it. At the 221st annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in January, All the buzz was about drastically ramping up the flow of tax dollars into sky surveys to detect and analyze, quote, near-Earth asteroids. It seems that some 20,000 of these hulking chunks of rock, ice, and who knows what are orbiting around our solar system. Yet only 6,000 of them have been identified. The professional sky watchers say that at the current pace of detecting and probing this plethora of asteroids zipping around and at us, not only are we in grave danger of being smacked by some, but we're also missing one heck of an economic opportunity, for there's gold in them thar skies. With dollars in their eyes, several astronomers predict that many asteroids contain rich veins of platinum, cobalt, zinc, and other valuable metals, as well as such essential human needs as oxygen and hydrogen. Let's go get it, is their exuberant cry. First, they demand, fund us and our technological probes to find out what's in each chunk of space stuff, then finance manned missions to harvest the goodies. This is Jim Hightower saying, how fracking wonderful is this? Our expertise at exploitation of natural resources need not be earthbound. We have it within us to mess up the whole cosmos.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Yeah, it's not a moral objection. This is about the free exercise of religion. And under our Constitution, you don't take a poll to find out how people feel about a constitutional freedom. In fact, the Bill of Rights are designed to protect minority views. So what the overall view on the issue of contraception is has nothing to do with an issue about religious freedom. And in this country, the government doesn't get to tell you or your organization what your religious views are, and they could well be minority views. But the Bill of Rights is designed to protect the minority from the will of the majority. Holy diver, you've been down
too long in the midnight sea. Yeah, see, see, I love that, the Edgar G. Robinson. Yeah, see, yeah. Love that guy, even though he's crazy as a loon. But yeah, you look at that, and the whole contraception argument, which is kind of blows my mind. You look at this new study that was just released by the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancies. And not surprising. I mean, again, you look at these studies and you go, come on, did you really have to go through the whole process? It's common sense. They point out that the teen birth rate in rural areas is nearly a third higher than it is in more urban areas. And that teen pregnancy rates have been considerably slower to decline in those rural counties here in the past decade. No real surprise there. And what they say is, look, you know, it's the barriers to birth control. And look, where I live in Carlisle, you know, I remember a couple of the girls who were in with the Dickinson College Democrats. You know, they had gone around to the local pharmacies trying to find the Plan B pill. Didn't exist. They couldn't get doctors who would prescribe it. In fact, the doctors would say, well, you know, we'll give you a prescription, you know, in 72 hours. You know, not happening. The other part is, you know, you've got simple minds who, you know, fail to realize that this head in the sand, abstinence only nonsense is just that, head in the sand. And I guess, you know, the other argument is there's really nothing to do. You know, it's like the guy who told me he was one of 19 kids, and when I asked, I was just a small kid at the time. And I asked, you know, why his parents had 19 kids. They said they didn't have TV. So I guess it could be just that as well. But, you know, I look at this, and you look at the in talking with Ann Chu there, the extremists really have taken over the Republican Party, if you really look at it. And I'm hoping there are some. And I look at this Scott Riggle, the Republican from Virginia, who said that he'd consider raising revenue in order, you know, by cutting tax loopholes to do away with this sequester. He said, you know, I want our leadership to consider it and not just reject it outright. Even the thought of considering it is going against the Republican principles right now. And I look at these devastating cuts that could happen, and what I see from the right is this, like, this total dismissiveness. Well, you know, it's only a couple percent. It's not that much. You know, the one guy asked about the Department of Transportation budget because he was one of the reporters asked Ray LaHood He said, wow, it's only 1.4% of your budget. You can't find $1 billion out of a $74 billion budget? And the guy's like, look, it's a lot of money. We're talking about a lot of jobs. We've already squeezed, and we've already squeezed. I mean, it's like that there have been no cuts in the past. And I guess you keep on this path of we need to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze until the eagle screams on the quarter. We're down to the bone. And, you know, you listen to here in Pennsylvania, Senator Scarnati said, look, you know, we're down to the bone. Any deeper, we're going through. And it's this mindset that, wow, we could just take more from those people. And it's always in that frame. It's always those people. We could always take more. You're going to tell me in that budget we can't get more? And Littlehood was saying, look, the reality is you're going to furlough 47,000 people. They're going to lose a day to 2 days per pay period. And you've got Republicans saying, well, you know, that's not a big deal. It's only a day, you know, day a week. Not a big deal. Yeah, over 6 months, that's almost an entire month. So you tell me if you can take a 20% pay cut. And this whole thing with the FAA, that's just one agency that's going to see massive cuts. But again, it's this head in the sand stuff. I mean, that's just the FAA. I mean, you look at the food inspectors. You're going to be at more risk for foodborne illnesses. You're going to see all kind of stuff if this is allowed to happen. And I know you're being alarmist. No. You know, it's like when I was in the hospital. I had my gallbladder taken out over the summer, and the very next week after having it taken out, I was back in the hospital with the exact same symptoms that I had that put me in. And the doctor at a certain point said, you know, your numbers aren't coming down. In fact, they're going up. So we've got to have a conversation about what could happen. We don't know if it's going to, but you need to know. And I'm grateful for that. And I think as a nation, we need to know what's going to happen if this is allowed to continue. What's down the road? I mean, you cannot make an informed, intelligent choice without knowing the consequences. And this is something the Republicans don't seem to think much about. The consequences. Who's going to hurt? Because it's not going to hurt them. Not going to hurt their donors. It's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt me. It's going to hurt workers in these jobs. And that's a damn shame. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. You lose my business hat. I'm on to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states filed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13, did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting And the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our haters. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Yes, the billionaire hath spoken, and not just a billionaire 25, 26 times over, the mayor of New York City hath spoken. The veto on this bill that would have said, hey, you know what? If you're an employer, you can't discriminate against someone who's been unemployed. And, you know, I always thought that, you know, you put job ads in the newspaper so people who don't have jobs could go get them because you want to bring people in, and it shouldn't matter that you've been out of work for 3 months. You look at the crisis that we've just come out of. I know people who have been unemployed for a year or two. And the sad reality is, the stories that they tell me, that's one of the big things holding against them. So, you know, there's part of me that says the old adage is always easier to find a job when you've got one. Probably true. But this veto, again, just, you know, another one of those, the billionaire class has spoken, which is why I've asked Michael Kink of Strong for All to come talk to us about that and a little bit more of what's going on in the employment market. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So I look at this veto, and I know, again, it's just another example in my view of the wealth class, the business-friendly folks saying, well, nothing you say, nothing government will do, going to change our mind. We're going to do what we want, and the hell with you.
And it's particularly bad in New York. You know, we've got a billionaire mayor. We've got the worst income inequality in the country. I think, you know, Bloomberg is radically out of touch with the way that people are living in the neighborhoods of New York City. The city council is overwhelmingly progressive and Democrat. They've identified the clear needs. A lot of their constituents are qualified for jobs. They need jobs, and these job postings are kicking them out before they even have a chance to apply.
Yeah.
It's a straightforward proposal. Other cities and states have done it, but the Bloomberg billionaire, you know, he don't care.
And the thing is, you know, you see these, you know, like Walmart had opened up in where I grew up in Cleveland, and there were, I think, 3,000 people who showed up for these 300 jobs, and to go, the first line of kicking people out is anyone unemployed, we're throwing to the curb. You know that happens. So in looking at this bill that he vetoed, what would this have done? What would the law have done?
Well, first it would have banned the postings. It would have said you can't post that, you can't set that, it's not a reasonable requirement for a job. Second of all, it would have allowed people that were specifically rejected because of their unemployment status to sue for damages. And I think that's the part that employers are afraid of. That's the part that got the business lead in New York all fired up. They were worried about lawsuits
right. From
angry unemployed New Yorkers who are qualified for jobs who weren't hired because of their employment status. So I think the council is likely to override the governor's veto. I think this is a populist issue. It's a popular issue. I think there are millions and millions of New Yorkers that understand that the council is doing the right thing and Bloomberg is doing the wrong thing.
You know, what do you say to them that says, you know, because I think Bloomberg, what the statement that he made said that, you know, you can't legislate hiring.
Well, we legislate the terms and conditions of fair hiring all the time. You can't discriminate against people of color. You can't discriminate against people with disabilities if they're able to do the job. You can't discriminate on the basis of age or gender. You know, this is exactly the same thing. The lines around the block are there for job fairs. There are plenty of people who are qualified, who are ready to work. And I don't think the fact that you don't have a job should be a bar for a job that you're qualified for. I think that's a reasonable law, and I think the council's on the right track.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, you see the wealth class and the business community pushing back at this. Because, look, I mean, times are there's a surplus of labor out there. And they're going to pick and choose. And you know, I saw an analogy. It's like musical chairs right now. If you're not in the game, you're not getting a job. And you look nationally, more than one in three of the unemployed have been looking for a job for at least 6 months. There's a serious problem. And like I said earlier, I know people who have been off for a year. I know a couple people who have been off for 2 years, and they can't even get interviews anymore.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jersey outlawed this. You know, Chris Christie is not a flaming socialist, right? I mean, I think it's possible to do this in a straightforward way, and I think Bloomberg is just flat out wrong. I think the council will overrule him, and I think New York workers who are unemployed will have a shot at applying for jobs on a fair basis.
Yeah. The other part of this is, you know, I've always advocated for, you know, doing away with extended unemployment and making government employer of last resort so that this kind of an issue doesn't come up. I mean, at the end of the 26 weeks, we find something for you to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, that is a tremendously popular proposition. If you poll that, you know, people that describe themselves as conservative Republicans are very much in favor of a government kind of WPA-style job program that makes sure that people have good, productive employment if they can't find work. And so I think that's something America needs. I think that's something that we were able to experiment with some of the spending that was in the stimulus in 2009. There were more significant funds for job creation programs and jobs as alternatives to welfare and unemployment than we'd seen in a long time. In New York, we spent $44 million a year to create tens of thousands of jobs. And, you know, the people that had those jobs got real paychecks. They weren't on public assistance. They weren't on unemployment. They had health benefits. They were doing productive work. We need to do a hell of a lot more of that.
I'm right there with you, because at the end of the day, we're spending an awful lot of time bickering and fighting over issues like this, which, to me, I can't even imagine that you would be allowed to say, if you don't have a job, don't bother applying. To me, that's almost like saying, if you're a man or a woman or you're a minority, don't bother applying. It seems to me to be in the same vein.
Yeah, I mean, by definition. And, you know, the economy we have right now is not creating many jobs, and it's only creating low-wage jobs. You know, in New York, we're losing high-paying jobs. We're losing medium-paying jobs. We're only creating low-wage jobs.
Yep, a lot of McDonald's jobs.
It's not like people are moving up the career ladder. I mean, they're desperately trying to find work to support their families.
Yeah, and, you know, I looked at, we'd spoken to folks from New York when they had the one-day strike of the fast food restaurants, the McDonald's and the Wendy's.
Yep.
And, you know, to me, all of this ties into minimum wage. All of this ties into labor rights. I truly believe that we need to be working to make the big box retailers get those workers into unions, get fast food workers into unions, get them all in to say, you know what? I shouldn't have to work a million hours in a year to make what the CEO makes like the folks at McDonald's have to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a mixture of public and private actions that can make this better, right? We need to unionize. We need to get more people into collective bargaining where they and their colleagues can negotiate with employers on a fair basis and demand fair pay. We need things like a minimum wage increase at the federal level, a minimum wage increase at the state level. We need to make sure that government subsidies are tied to living wages. You know, step by step, if there's only going to be low-wage jobs, then we got to make those jobs better.
Yep.
If we don't do that, then the economy is just permanently destined to be into this wild division between the rich and the poor.
Well, I go back to my grandparents' generation, and, you know, the reality is my grandfather was a truck driver for years, and when he started in the industry as a young man back in the 40s, Not a high paying job. Not a good job at all. His brother started in factory work. Not a good job there at all. And I know people who were in mining at the time. Not a great job at all. It was through collective bargaining. It was through negotiating that made those jobs solidly middle class jobs. And I say we have to do the exact same thing with the existing jobs today.
And the money is there. The profits are there and the productivity is there.
Yep.
These industries are incredibly profitable. The workers are very productive. They're just not getting their fair share of the gains. At big box retailers, at fast food companies, at, you know, smaller service places, grocery stores, car wash employers, all of these places have the top executives and the owners making big, big, big bucks. And the thing about unionization, the thing about fair action by government is demanding that people are paid fairly, that they get a share of the fruit of their labor.
I mean, there's something seriously wrong when you look at McDonald's, for instance. Their CEO makes a million times the hourly wage of one of their frontline workers. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. And you look at during the election, during the presidential election, Papa John, who put himself right in the mix, look at his palatial estate, just a beautiful place. I mean, just an amazing piece of craftsmanship, amazing home and all of that off the backs of low-wage workers.
It is crazy, you know, and some of those fast food workers in Brooklyn were telling us how it's kind of a known thing that the checks from Wendy's bounce. You know, that if you get your paycheck and you're actually paid the sadly low amount of money you get paid, then they bounce your paychecks. I don't think they bounce the checks to the CEO. You know, I don't think that his paychecks bounce,
no.
But the workers' paychecks bounce.
And that's something that I hope that, and maybe you as someone on the ground are seeing people with the light coming on in their eyes. Because for years, people were sold this bill of goods that, well, you know, we're thankful to have a job. The benevolent corporation gives me this. And, you know, at some point, I'm hoping that, you know, the old saying, there's only so much of you know what people are willing to eat. I'm hoping we're at that point.
I think it's happening. You know, I think that Occupy sweeping the nation. I think in the unionization drives that are happening in New York and Chicago and L.A. I think the state-by-state efforts to raise the minimum wage, and now the president finally getting behind a $9 increase of the minimum wage with indexing for inflation.
Which I think
those
is pathetic.
Are all positive signs.
Which I think is pathetic.
Well, you know, it gets us closer to where folks need to be, but certainly in a state like New York, you know, even upstate outside of the big cities, you need $12 to live a sustainable life, right? To make enough money on one job to support a family. In New York City, it's closer to 15 or 18. You know, we have been fighting here in New York. Governor Cuomo, after a couple of years of being relatively conservative, stepped up in his State of the State speech this year, proposed an increase in the minimum wage higher than the Assembly Speaker had previously proposed. When President Obama proposed 9 with indexing, the Assembly and the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus immediately came out, amended their bills, said let's get to Obama's position, the new national standard. And the governor spent much of this week kind of musing to himself at press conferences over whether this was going to be something he could do, that Obama somehow had complicated his efforts to raise the minimum wage, when the fact is that, you know, the American people want this kind of stuff to happen, right?
Yep, 70%
absolutely. Of the people are in favor of $9 in indexing at the federal level. I think our minimum wage increase effort here in New York is at 80% of public approval rating. 95% of African-American respondents are for it. People are way ahead of the politicians, and it's time for government to finally catch up. I think we got to get some of these increases into workers' paychecks, and then we got to keep fighting.
Well, that's how the economy gets turned around. People have money. The people who spend money have money in their pocket, and they go into the economy and spend. That's
yeah,
how it works. It's pretty
even
simple
working
stuff.
With businesses, you know, consumer demand is the number one problem, right? If you put $1.5 billion more in workers' paychecks here in New York by raising the minimum wage to $9, that's going to create a lot of consumer demand. People are going to buy food at bodegas. People are going to buy clothes and shoes for their kids. I mean, that stuff that goes directly in the economy. It doesn't buy, you know, a $3 million armoire on Madison Avenue. It doesn't buy a $100 million piece of art. It's money that's injected directly into the economy.
And the thing that upsets me about the president coming out for a $9 an hour minimum wage, which, and that's all, it's over a couple of years, and yeah, I know there's indexing there, is that's the bargaining point. And anybody who's ever sat down at a negotiating table knows you don't start off with what you're willing to take. You start off a bit higher, which I would have said 10 bucks and settled back on 9, but not start off at 9.
No, I agree with you. And I don't think that, you know, the American people are going to wince for 1 second at 10 bucks. I think you'd see the same 70% public approval rating for 10 bucks that you see for 9 bucks, and it would be closer to reality. You know, the other thing that's probably going to happen is those crazy Republicans and Tea Party activists are going to fight this.
Yeah.
We're going to make an election issue. I know last year in New York there were 3 or 4 state Senate candidates that spoke out very directly about the minimum wage being their top priority, and they won their races. And part of the reason they won their races is that people realize that some candidates running for office are connected to what they're talking about. They're not talking about austerity. They're not talking about cuts. They're talking about more jobs and putting more in your paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that gets me is the states that would benefit most from a raise in the minimum wage are generally the states where those crazy right-winger, those extremists come from.
It is very, very difficult. And you know, in a state, you know, some of the Alabama, Mississippi, the, you know, $9 an hour might go a long, long way down there. That's something that people should be, you know, incredibly for. But again, those will be the elected representatives that will fight the hardest to block it.
It's just mind-blowing. And you know what I love is I love hearing people tell me, well, you know, the only people that take those minimum wage jobs are high school kids who need a little beer money on the weekends.
It's ridiculous. You know, here in New York, 84% of the people that make minimum wage are adults, only 16% of kids. And the kids, you know, I work with this woman, Cassandra Guzman. She's a 18-year-old high school student from Corona, Queens. She works as few as 8 and as many as 12 hours at the grocery store near her house making minimum wage. And she does it to help her family make the rent. They pay $1,300 on 2 rooms in Corona, Queens. She's got 3 little brothers and sisters, and the whole family works together. You can't tell me that a teenager is making money for PlayStation. She's making money for rent.
Yeah, and the sad reality is, and I talked about this last night, I took my kids back to where I grew up in Cleveland, and I said, you know, when I was a kid, when I was, you know, 8 years old, got my first paper route and had a paper route all the way through until I was well into high school, those jobs are gone. I mean, because the parents need them now to put food on the table.
Absolutely. The people that deliver my paper every day, those are adults with cars. And, you know, I'll tell you, this is one of the things where you see the difference between unionized jobs and non-unionized jobs. You know, we did some town halls around the state of New York last fall around some of these issues of economic inequality. And, you know, up in Glens Falls in the Adirondacks, there are apprenticeship classes for HVAC technicians that are working at the new chip fab plants up there. They're union jobs. They make living wages. The other alternative are big box retailers, Target, Walmart, where you have to work, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 jobs to support a family. And that is the stark division. Union jobs make better wages. You get more of the productive benefits that you're accruing to your employer. These big box work retailers, the fast food workers, they're taking all the money and they're leaving nothing for the workers.
Yeah, but, you know, but even the big box retailers, I mean, I go back to my grandmother during the, you know, the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, worked at a department store in Cleveland, which was unionized. When the company went out of business because the Walmarts came into town, she was making $8 an hour in 1985 with 6 weeks vacation,
right,
health care, dental, vision, all of that stuff. They're not even making that now. They don't get the benefits that they got then. And why is that? No voice.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I'm proud that RWDSU is one of the unions that's members of Strong Economy for All Coalition. We have worked side by side with them on some of these unionization drives, on some of the minimum wage increases. But, you know, the fact is that we need a massively bigger organized labor movement in this country if we're going to turn this economy around. The kind of clout that you can work with a government to make better things happen, the kind of clout that it takes to negotiate with these employers and get more of a share for the workers.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And it's something that we're going to have to do, and hopefully that, as you've said, you're seeing the spark in the eye, and maybe there's enough of people have taken it enough, and we're going to take to the streets and redo what my grandparents' generation did. Fight on the shop floor, fight on the streets, and demand a fair, decent wage. Michael Kink, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Strong for all the web. org, the website. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth. Sky.
After a large meteor exploded over Russia in February 2013, many were comparing the event to one that also happened in Russia a century before.
That earlier event happened on June 30, 1908, in a remote part of Russia. As in 2013, witnesses saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky. Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia. It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations of the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of the Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30, 1908. As in 2013, the object appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above Russia. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. We're hoping next Saturday, Keystone Progress is going to have their Pennsylvania Progressive Summit 2013, Fighting Back, Moving Forward, is the buzzword on that. Speakers from around the country are going to come and talk about how we move the country in the right direction. We will be there setting up a table, talking to people, doing the interviews, bringing you the latest information. But I think being there is so important, and we're going to enjoy talking to folks. It's always a great time and a good networking opportunity to see what's going on, what people are doing. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also looking forward to seeing their keynote speaker, David Cobb, who is the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. Their goal is to, corporations are not people. Amend the Constitution and say, look, those inalienable rights, those are for people, not corporations. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
To the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Defense Department has dire warnings for employees waiting for the sequester deadline to fall. Jesse Russell reports.
The Department of Defense issued a warning to civilian employees on Wednesday that as many as 800,000 workers could be put on unpaid leave if budget cuts triggered by the sequester are allowed to move forward in March. Part of the plan being considered by the Pentagon is to put personnel on leave for one day per week for at least 22 weeks. Those employees would see their pay cut by 20% by the unpaid furloughs. Such a loss in pay would not only directly impact the families losing that pay, but also communities with high employment of federal workers. Roughly $1.1 billion would be lost by employees living in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia combined. The sequester would also prevent the renewal of expiring contracts and adoption of new contracts, creating a ripple effect in areas of the private sector that depend on government contracting.
Detroit activist attorney Jerome Goldberg is a founder of Moratorium Now. That's an organization seeking a moratorium on foreclosures to keep working families in their homes. Moratorium Now networks with activists and other organizations around the country pushing for a moratorium. Goldberg says President Obama actually has the authority to declare a moratorium. Goldberg says the federal government now controls most of the mortgages in the U.S. through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA due to government bailouts. As he represents clients facing foreclosures, Goldberg says banks often refuse to work with homeowners on mortgage modifications because it's more profitable for them to throw families out. Banks can often use the government bailout to collect full mortgage values, even on homes that have dropped in value, if they foreclose rather than allow loan modifications.
Why shouldn't the federal government, instead of using tax dollars to toss people out in the street, put a moratorium on foreclosures? And we believe that President Obama, through an executive order, can do just that.
The AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Thursday released a joint statement on shared principles concerning immigration reform. Those principles include that Americans should have first crack at available jobs, but that laws permit businesses to hire foreign workers without going through a cumbersome and inefficient process to do it when needed. The Labor Federation and the Chambers say the challenge is to create a mechanism that responds to the needs of business while also fully protecting the wages and working conditions of U.S. and immigrant workers. The two organizations are often on opposite sides of issues, but their joint statement says the nation needs to fix the immigration system in part by establishing a professional bureau in a federal executive agency with political independence to inform Congress and the public about immigration issues. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the IBEW. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this
is. Yes, what a wonderful world it would be if those workers, if they had no rights at all. And you know, I love the good senator from South Carolina saying, well, you know, it really is a freedom versus tyranny issue. And I would agree. It absolutely is. The only problem is the tyranny is on the other side. When you look at the fact that the National Labor Relations Act, it's all about the rights of workers, not employers. I don't know where that came from. Written, as our friend Irwin Aronson says, out of whole cloth, just appeared. But not one single word, not one single phrase, nothing in that act gives any rights to the employers. It's all about giving rights to workers. The ability to stand, the ability to collectively bargain, which right now we're seeing the right wing in this country full tilt trying to take away. So when I see an employer who decides, well, we're gonna kick you to the curb or we're not gonna negotiate, and I see workers standing together, standing strong and fighting back, these are stories we need to hear. This, which is why I've asked Francesca Carranza. She is a worker at the Castlewood Country Club out in Oakland, California, to come talk to us about their recent victory. Francesca, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me here.
So you work for what appears to be a fairly prestigious country club, correct?
It is very prestigious, and it's out in Pleasanton. It's very prestigious city too.
So, you know, I look at this and you get the upper crust, the 1% in there, I guess, as members, yet they wanted to pay you guys basically poverty wages with no benefits and no future.
Right. That's all they wanted to do. You know, just have their very elegant club and have, like, top service and treat their employees like they're nothing.
So how long has this battle been going on? I know this has been a long quest for this contract. How long have you been fighting this?
Our contract expired in September of 2009, and we started negotiations at that time. We went on to next year, and in February of 2010, the club decided to close the doors on the employees, locking us out. And we were out for about almost 3 years, 2 years, 7 months, and 22 days. And finally, in October 16th of last year, we went back to work.
And how did you get back to work?
We filed complaints with the National Labor Board Relations, and it was a long process. And finally, we went. Five workers went out there, gave testimony of what the club was trying to do, which basically was taking our rights away, taking them away. They wanted to take away our seniority. They wanted to take away, you know, the job security that we had until then. And they wanted us to pay a lot for health insurance. And by a lot, I mean, I make $12 an hour. That's roughly $160 bi-weekly. And they wanted us to pay $739 a month for insurance.
Wow.
So that basically meant leaving one of my bi-monthly checks there for insurance.
We
couldn't have that.
And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, because I know you guys do the food service, you do the maintenance, the janitorial work. Why would the 1% want sick employees around them? Why would they want people without health care, without insurance around them? I mean, I would think the people that are taking care of you, the people who are feeding you your meals, those are the people you want to treat like kings and queens.
Not to them. You know, we were out there and they told us that they didn't want us back, that we could go back home. And when they said back home, they meant back down to Mexico. They said that we didn't belong there. You know, and it was particularly hurting for people who've been there for over 25 years.
Jeez.
Faithfully serving these people.
I don't know what going back to anywhere has got to do with anything. In this country, workers have rights. And I've said, I don't care where you're from. A job in this country has got to come with dignity and respect and a decent wage. And I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's you, me, the guy across the street. A job in this country should be a job in this country.
That's what a human being with feelings will think. But according to them, they told me right in my face, who do you think you are that you think that you deserve for me to pay your health insurance? And this was like a guy who was paying 60 cents a day, you know, for my insurance. That was all. That was all. And I would tell him, you know, if I had, they would say, why do you think that you deserve for me to pay your health insurance? And why don't you go get a better job? Why don't you go, instead of standing out here picketing, why don't you go out and look for another job?
Well, because I'm going to fight and make this one better. And maybe if you did the same thing, we wouldn't have these problems. You know, I get
That's
a kick
right.
out of people who say that, well, if you don't like the conditions, go somewhere else. And I go, you know, I believe in making my place better so that you can have a better place as well, so that we all rise up together.
That was my answer. You know, why would I go looking for another job if I have a job here?
And I can't imagine over.
Yeah, it's nice that way. I all I want to do is come here, do my work, go home and have a check. You know, with dignity, put some food on my table for my kids. You know, be able to take them to the doctor, be able to send them to school with, you know, a coat over their backs, and have a roof over their heads. That's all I want. And I want to do it with dignity, and you're not allowing me to do that. They told us that for insurance, we could go to welfare. We could go to the Medi-Cal. We could go to the public clinics. And I said, you know, I've been there. I've done that. And I got out of the system because I couldn't live in it anymore. Because they treat people, you know, like trash, like garbage. To them, I don't want to be another number in the statistics of an already saturated system. I want to be able to work and be able to pay my own insurance and be able to provide for my kids without going onto the public assistance. You know, they told us to wait. Why would we want them to pay for our insurance if, you know, in 2014, Obama's plan was going to kick in? That's what they told us.
Wow.
All you have to do is wait for this plan, and everybody's going to be covered. Everybody's going to be okay.
So we're gonna cheat you down the road, and we're going to make you suffer, because we need shared sacrifice. I'm sure you heard probably a lot of that. You know, things are tough on the very wealthy. Things are tough on the 1%. And they can't afford, you know, the dues anymore, and so we can't pay you. Was that the argument, or was it just we have this power, and we're going to do it because we can?
That's basically what they were telling us. You know, I can do this, not because I can't afford it, because we have enough money. But
I mean,
just because you guys don't deserve, you know, you guys are privileged that you have been working here, and you don't deserve for us to pay for your insurance.
It's a privilege.
We did a hunger strike for Mother's Day on the first year of the lockout. And they came and told us, well, you don't look like you're starving, you know. And so I said, you know, I'm standing here because you guys are having a feast in there for Mother's Day, and there's people out here, there's mother here who are my co-workers, and these people have kids in the army, you know, fighting for this country, and you guys are treating us like we're nothing. Something's not right here. And they told us that we were dumb, uneducated, and that we didn't know what we were fighting for.
I mean, I go back to John Edwards' Two Americas, and what you've just laid out is really a very stark look at the two Americas, the people who make the mess and the people who clean up after them. And the people who have unlimited resources and folks who are struggling at the margins. And you look at this, you said 2009 they kicked you guys to the curb. Over 3 years fighting this battle. There's something seriously wrong with our labor law.
Yes, it was in February 2010. And our co-workers and I decided to stand there, stay together, you know, being one force. And we managed to beat the club, beat the members, and went back in there to work with our heads held very high. And we won, you know, on February the 13th of this year, we voted on a contract that was offering us affordable health care, that was providing us, you know, to accrue seniority. We have job security, and we have everything that we were asking for back when they closed the doors on us.
Good
for you.
Good for you. And you know, for people who don't know how this works, how did you do it? I mean, how do you keep, given the economy, given the collapse of the economy in 2008 and all the rough, how do you keep that number of people together? And were you able to pull in local politicians, local faith leaders, local people to put pressure on them? How did you get this done?
It was hard, but we did boycott the club. And we went out to customers, we went out to the members, we went out to faith communities, we went out to other unions, we went out to the community in Pleasanton, to politicians, and we explained what was going on, and we were asking for support. We were telling clients of the club, you know, who were coming to have weddings and tournaments and events there, to support the workers, because these people were taking advantage, using their money to fight us and to keep us on the street. When we told them that what they said about, you know, us going to Medi-Cal and us being, you know, already a burden on other taxpayers, they will support us. We had priests from different churches coming in, pray with us, even going up to the club and asking them, open their hearts and do what was right. And they denied talking to these people. They denied. We had the majority leader, Alberto Torrico, come in, and the general manager refused to even shake his hand.
Wow.
You know, so we had several other politicians. They refused to listen to anyone. They refused to talk to anyone. at some point they were refusing to talk to the press to make any kind of statement. But I would say, like I said, we just stood there. We were by the side of the road with our pickets demanding justice and demanding, you know, fair treatment.
Yep.
And at the end, we got it. Yeah,
congratulations on a victory, a hard-fought victory. Hopefully this never has to happen again. Hopefully the message has been sent. But the reason I asked you on is people need to hear these stories. We need to hear the stories of people standing strong and fighting back and winning, because what you've done and what your coworkers have done is a model for, I think, everyone else. If we can force the 1% to give in and to give us count, we can win.
Yes, I think that this company, this bosses, rich bosses, they take advantage of the workers. When workers are not together, when workers are uninformed, that they don't know their rights and they don't know what they can do. You know, they don't know that if they stand together, they can move mountains.
Absolutely.
I mean, literally. And I'm here, you know, to tell every worker to stand strong and don't let anybody take advantage of you, because you have a right. You are here doing an honest day's work, and you don't have to be ashamed for what you do. If you pick up garbage, if you clean toilets, if you know, if you wash dishes, whatever it is that you do, do it with pride and do it with dignity, because this is like supporting your family. This is your livelihood, and you shouldn't be embarrassed, and nobody should treat you bad because of that.
And you should be able to support your family and make a decent wage, a respectable living wage. I'm right there with you. Francesca, I appreciate the time. Congratulations. Congratulate all your coworkers on a fight well fought. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me here.
Let's take a quick break back right after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
With all the woes that we humans have inflicted on our weary old earth, from the reckless plundering of her resources to the self-destructive tampering with her climate, perhaps it's time we give her a break. What, you want us to cut back on our fracking, ransacking, scorched earth ways? No, of course not. I merely mean that the good earth is getting a bit, shall we say, depleted. So, to maintain our insatiable appetite for devouring our own environment, shouldn't we be seeking greener pastures to exploit? Good news, our scientists are already on top of it. At the 221st annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in January, all the buzz was about drastically ramping up the flow of tax dollars into sky surveys to detect and analyze, quote, near-Earth asteroids. It seems that some 20,000 of these hulking chunks of rock, ice, and who knows what are orbiting around our solar system, yet only 6,000 of them have been identified. The professional sky watchers say that at the current pace of detecting and probing this plethora of asteroids zipping around and at us, not only are we in grave danger of being smacked by some, but we're also missing one heck of an economic opportunity, for there's gold in them thar skies. With dollars in their eyes, several astronomers predict that many asteroids contain rich veins of platinum, cobalt, zinc, and other valuable metals, as well as such essential human needs as oxygen and hydrogen. Let's go get it, is their exuberant cry. First, they demand, fund us and our technological probes to find out what's in each chunk of space stuff. Then, finance manned missions to harvest the goodies. This is Jim Hightower saying, how fracking wonderful is this? Our expertise at exploitation of natural resources need not be earthbound. We have it within us to mess up the whole cosmos. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door, there's holds the throne. I've been looking for the map that leads me home. I've been somewhere on good hearts turning to stone. Good intentions is gonna dry as a bone. We take care of our own. We take care of our own.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, she said something that caught my attention. That they told, the employer said, well, just go get the Medicaid, the Medi-Cal they have there. Go get the state insurance. Go to the, on the back of the taxpayer, because we, the employer, don't want to pay you. And, you know, it clicked into my head as I was recalling the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania who sent out their welfare cliff. You know, there's another cliff. I love the Republicans and their language, the welfare cliff, and that's the cliff at which it doesn't pay to work anymore. And, you know, they use these astronomical numbers, like, you know, if a single mother makes $69,000 a year with a child, there's no incentive for her to take a raise. And we found one. The vast majority of workers don't make $69,000 a year, especially single mothers. What I find really hysterical is you get these employers, the Walmarts, the big box retailers, the country clubs. I mean, think about that for a second. You're talking about a very prestigious country club, a very, very costly country club, lucrative, and they want to cheat their employees, and they want, this is... I mean, you can't get to any better imaging than this. You've got the upper echelon of the 1% wanting the folks who are in that bottom 20% to take care of them and do it for basically free and have the taxpayers pay for it. I mean, that's really what we're talking about. The people who clean up after their mess, who serve them their meals, take away clean their toilets, clean their locker rooms, do all of that stuff. Well, those people, those aren't real jobs. And I like what she said at the end. You know, no matter what you do, no matter what it is you do, do it with pride and dignity and respect. And what we've done in this country, and I just had this conversation the other day that, I blame the baby boom generation for this, and I blame them for a lot, but this is part of it as well. That it's no longer something that to be looked up to that, oh, you're a construction worker, you build things with your hands, or you're an auto mechanic, or a truck driver or whatever. We've really degraded types of work because it's not a professional job. And I look at this and I go, you know, that goes back to, you know, me growing up. And, you know, even my grandparents who said, you know what, if you become a truck driver when you grow up, you'll be a failure. And I guess once you've had that pounded into your head enough, and I think my generation really has had that, you know, to be a success, you had to be some kind of a businessman. You know, it's all about, you know, being a business criminal. And that's probably unfair. No, it's not. And they pounded that into our heads as kids. You got to go to college. You got to get a good job with an office in the corner. And it was never about, you know, being someone who swung a hammer or someone who drove a truck or you know, did cement work or any of that stuff or a plumber or electrician or any of that. It was about getting that office job. And that was the measure of success. Even though those office jobs don't pay nearly as much as those construction jobs. And it takes me back to, you know, the thought. all these thoughts just keep running through my head as I think this thing through on the fly. I mean, you know, I remember a guy I worked with. We used to throw boxes together on the shipping dock. We loaded trucks together. And he decided that he was going to he was going to take a management job, which meant a pretty sizable pay cut, meant less health care benefits. He'd have to pay more for his health care, less health care. His pension would be horrible. But he was okay with that because, well, he wouldn't have to tell his kids that he threw boxes for a living, that he was in management, that there were people under him. And we've done that to ourselves, that we're... And it's ignorant to me on so many levels. It reminds me of my ex-wife kind of saying the same thing. You know, her with a master's degree, I made more money than she did throwing boxes on a shipping dock. And she said, well, why don't you take a job over here in management, even though I'd have made less money. And her thing was, but, you know, then you'd be management. And I go, but no, I'd be making less money. I'd be poor. And I always kept saying to her, you know, and the people that she worked with who were the, you know, the management types, because they had college degrees, that you folks are getting screwed. You people who work in offices, you folks who are working middle management, you need collective bargaining agreements as much as I do, because you're the one who's getting shafted. And what it was is they were sold this idea that, well, I'm a professional. I can make my own deal. And I don't care what you do for a living. I don't care if you swing a hammer, clean a toilet, or you're a computer programmer, or you shift papers around from one side of your desk to the other. You're still an employee. You're still part of the hierarchy, man. You're still punching the clock. You're still on the treadmill. And that job should pay. You should get some of the profit from what you do, don't you think? And I ask, you know, what is it about us where we're okay with working for less than we're worth? You know, I remember my ex-wife worked at a chemical plant, and you know the production people were unionized, but it was the lab and the office people who were not. And the lab and the office people made less than the uneducated production workers. Again, those production workers had a collective bargaining agreement. The really educated people, the people with degrees, master's degrees, most of them, they did not. And what I always wondered is, you know, how'd they get so dumb being so smart? Because they've got all this education, they've got all this smarts, they've got the paper on the wall, and say, look, I'm a smart man. But they're working for less than somebody with a high school diploma working on a production line. And I remember going to these cocktail parties, and I remember being involved in all these discussions and asking these people, you know, how little is your time worth? How little is your life worth? How much would it cost? How much would it charge you? Because they would say, oh, those union people, they make too much. And I would say, well, how much can I pay you to come stand in my driveway in January? How much is your time worth? Just come and stand, and I'll give you 2 10-minute breaks and a half-hour lunch, unpaid, of course, the half-hour lunch. 10-minute breaks I'll give you because of the goodness of my heart, because that's what I got under my contract. How much would it cost me to do that? And they would say, oh, $20 an hour. Well, my number's higher than that. Why do you think yourself worth not so much? Because you've gone through all of this education. You're the smart one. And it's what really kind of makes me chuckle. The more educated we get, I shouldn't even say that, not that way. The more pieces of paper that we get to hang on the wall, the more credentials we put behind our name and on our resumes, the dumber it appears we're getting. And I point to that period where it really made me rethink education. Do we really need higher education? What we need is we need people like my grandfather, who barely had an eighth grade education. But you couldn't get anything by him because he had street smarts. Maybe our problem is we got too many book smart people and not enough street smart people. Maybe that's our problem. Because a street smart person would go, wait a second, let me explain this to me. This guy's got a master's degree, and he's making less than the guy who's got a high school diploma? Explain that to me. You're working 60 hours a week salaried, and the guy who's working 60 hours a week hourly is making more money than you are? Explain that to me. Oh, but you have a title, and business has done a great job at doing that. The Walmart cashier is not a cashier. No, no, she's an associate. I love the titles, man. When I worked on a garbage truck, I was a garbage man. Picked up garbage. I wasn't a sanitation engineer. I was a garbage man. Picked up garbage. And I did a damn good job of it. In fact, that's how I used to get ready for football. I would do the whole route myself, and I'd run the entire thing. It's a great workout. I can just see it now. The Rick Smith workout craze. Garbage man. Problem is I won't make any money off of it because I've just now given it away. But here again, you go back to that. And I remember those guys working on those garbage trucks. They made a decent living. Why? Because they had a collective bargaining agreement. The people who worked for the city who didn't, guess what? They made less. And you look at what's going on in this country right now. Every time you turn around, you're hearing, well, this contract being negotiated. Right now, I heard today, this afternoon, in Minnesota, the security guards, the security officers there, the companies walked away from the table. Probably going to be a strike on Monday. We'll cover that on Monday. But they've got a contract. You're hearing about it because they're saying no. They're saying it's not going to happen. We're going to fight you on it. And they've got the power and numbers to do it. In other cities where the security officers aren't organized, don't have a collective bargaining agreement, guess what happens to them? Well, whatever management wants, it's imposed. You want to talk about a dictatorship? Right there. It's imposed. You will take a 10% pay cut or there's the door. And I've talked to so many people who, you know, I just came to work one day and they said, sorry, we're cutting your pay, or moreover, we're raising the cost of your benefits. No negotiating. So I love those people who tell me, well, you know, Rick, I can make my own deal. Well, you made your own deal, and they went back on it, right? And back on it again. And they, remember the 401ks when they first came out? Because I do. We'll match you, you know, dollar for dollar up to whatever percent. And then it was dollar for dollar up to a lower percent and 50%, 50 cents every dollar after that. And then it was, you know, well, only up to 50 cents up to whatever. And now it's like, sorry, we're not matching anything. We're administering the plan for you that you're still paying for. Again, more degrees, more pedigree, more credentials, less smart. Something seriously wrong with this country. We need a good set. We need to get people back in the streets so they get some street smarts. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, Penny Winners, 63, Walmart employee for about 7 years, charged with a felony after she was caught eating Oreos. Turns out, thought the Oreos on the shelf were, well, they're there for her. Decided that, I can't afford it because, you know, one of the reasons they, when they asked, when they arrested her, you know, why'd you steal the Oreos? I'm broke. I don't have any money. You don't pay me anything. Felony. Gonna go to jail probably for quite a bit of time. And while I don't condone stealing Oreos, I do look to Wall Street and I wonder how many of the people who destroyed our economy, how many of those people went to jail? So this woman, 63-year-old woman who can't afford to buy the cookies, took a couple of cookies, going to do time in jail. People who stole billions, we're going to put them back in charge because they know how to fix things. Blows the mind. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service on the line. Victoria, cookies or no cookies?
I think cookies.
I don't condone stealing, but, you know, when you look at what's going on, you look at these banksters who have robbed us blind and nobody really going to jail, the cookies, I don't know. I'm sorry.
I mean, you caught me at a minute when I'm hungry.
Okay, so pro-cookie.
So I'm pro-cookie right now.
Yeah, I'm not a big Oreo fan.
I'm not an Oreo fan either, but I am pro-cookie.
But, you know, they asked her, you know, why were you stealing junk food, you know, when they had other stuff, and she didn't really have an answer. And part of it goes, it's part of the culture. I mean, it's the low-wage workforce. That's what they usually can afford when they have the money to be able to afford it.
Well, exactly.
I don't know. And you think about the resource it's going to cost to put this woman in jail over cookies.
Oh, it's ridiculous. The amount of cookies it's going to cost to put her in jail is absurd.
There you go, pro cookie. All right, so what's going on in the, I understand the big fight breaking out as we speak in the House and Senate over the new Violence Against Women Act?
Yeah, because the Senate managed to pass a bipartisan Violence Against Women Act last week, 78-22, and that actually is genuinely bipartisan. That's
yep.
Not somebody saying it's bipartisan when you actually got one vote from the other party. And so they've been urging the House to model their legislation after the Senate bill. Well, we've now seen the House bill, which was introduced today, and it's really not exactly modeled after the Senate bill.
Okay, so are they pro-beating women, or what am I missing?
No, not exactly. Well, they do make some moves towards on some areas. They do move towards the Senate on the issue of giving tribal authorities the power to prosecute non-Indians in domestic violence cases. But with that, they give Indian courts some jurisdiction, but only after the Justice Department certifies that those courts are capable of protecting the defendant's constitutional rights. Apparently the courts aren't capable of deciding that for themselves.
Right.
But there's a couple of things. Senate Judiciary Chairman Pat Leahy, who's the chief sponsor of the bill, says the House bill will not provide critical protections for rape victims, domestic violence victims, human trafficking victims, or students on campuses or stalking victims. And Senator Patty Murray says it stripped out provisions in the Senate bill for the lesbian and gay community and drastically reduces protections for women on tribal lands.
Okay, it sounds like all the people who vote against Republicans anyway, so I don't think they're going to lose anything there.
Well, I mean, the difficulty is if they, you know, this bill gets introduced and it gets passed, then you've got two radically different bills which somehow have to be reconciled, And if you can't reconcile them, you're not going to get a bill.
So then what happens to the law?
We won't have one. We haven't got one now. We'll continue to not have a law.
I'm not happy about it.
It's a mess.
It is a mess. But again, you know, it's not surprising to me. I mean, you've got a party that's contrary to everything and anything that rational, common sense people would look at and say, well, you know, we should be doing. But there's part of me, to be honest, to give total authority to the tribal courts. You know, as a citizen of the U.S., you've got certain constitutional rights. I don't know how you balance those, though. I mean, if you're living on tribal land, and this stuff comes up, I can understand that, but what if you're in two separate places?
Well, that's right. No, if you're two separate places, that's right. Well, the idea was to find a way to balance it. The idea was to find a way to strike a balance. The feeling of those in the Senate is that the way that the House has balanced it is not the best way.
Right. So, you know, I guess, another crisis. I love crisis.
Another crisis.
It's good for radio.
We lurch.
It's good for radio. Maybe we could give them Oreo cookies.
They don't deserve cookies.
No cookies for them. They've got tea. They've got tea. They don't need cookies.
I think I'd strip out the tea.
We could throw them overboard. You look at the crisis that's going on right now. We're only a couple of days away from the grand sequester. Another one of these made up crises, one of these manufactured crises that as easily as we made it up, we could undo it. But no, we like pain. We like S&M. This is kind of like a Republican S&M, if you will.
I can't really comment on that, not knowing what Republican S&M's like, but I imagine it might be, in which case I do feel sorry for them if that's as imaginative as they get. But, yes, I think it probably is.
I mean, because you look at some of the things that have come out, the cuts, the furlough, the people being laid off. I don't know where this word furlough came from. They're laid off. They're losing a part of their pay. And I saw the one thing, what is it, they're going to lose up to 22 days over the next 6 months, so you could lose almost an entire month of the next 6 months of the people who work for the FAA, and you've got right wingers going, no big deal, that's okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been hearing this when I've been trying to explain this to some people that look, I'm on the red line this morning on the metro. I'm going to work with people who I know are about to lose 20% of their pay. Their mortgages and their rent are going to stay the same. Well, they should get a real job then. They shouldn't work for the government. I mean, I heard that today.
Yeah, the people who plow the roads and the people who do the food safety and the folks who sit in those towers to make sure our planes don't go crashing into each other. No, those aren't real jobs. Come on.
Yeah.
And I understand you're going to, according to LaHood, they're going to probably potentially could close over 100 air traffic control towers. You know, places like here in Harrisburg could be shut down, from what I understand.
Absolutely. They're probably going to shut down a large number, I mean, something like 60 or 100, and then there will be a large number that they will just stop the midnight shift.
So nobody flies at night. It's dark out anyway. You can't really see. Nobody flies at night.
Nobody flies at night. That's right. No more night flying. That's safer.
I'm okay with that. And we shouldn't do flying on Sundays. In fact, I'm not against the idea of going back to blue laws and nobody working on Sunday. Maybe the people of family values could take us back to having some family values.
Maybe they're behind the whole thing.
Could be it. Could be it. No flying at night. And why not if we're not going to deliver mail on Saturday, why not work Saturday or Sunday at all? Just none of that. Spend that time with your family.
We could put ourselves out of a job entirely with this,
Yeah, probably could. But, I mean, is this really going to happen? I mean, because you look at when you see the polling on this, most rational people go, this is insane. It's self-imposed. It's like saying, there's nothing wrong with my arm, but I said I'm going to cut it off, and, well, I have to cut it off.
you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we're 7 days out. We're nearly 6 days out at this point, as it's so close to 6 days, but it's still technically 7 days out. But there's only 4 days when Congress is in session until the sequester.
It's nice how that works.
Right, and they're not showing an awful lot of animation about doing anything about it. So at the moment, you've got to say, yeah, it looks like it's going to happen. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that these cuts aren't all going to hit on March the 1st, March the 2nd. When you send out furlough notices, as you know,
right,
you've got to give them 30 days notice. So the cuts aren't going to hit probably until April. So I think the lawmakers are thinking, oh, we've got some time to fix this.
Yeah, we can just keep, you know what I love about this, though, is, you know, all during the last election cycle, all I heard from the Republicans was, they kept talking about certainty. Business needs certainty.
Yes.
And I look at this, and again, another created crisis. Where's the certainty? And we're down to the wire again. And this isn't the first, and I guarantee it won't be the last that this scenario is played out and out and out. But where's the certainty? What about the business community that they're so concerned about? Because this is going to cost 750,000 jobs. The economy is going to constrict by, what, almost a full percent. Hey, there's some very real consequences to this manufactured crisis.
Yeah, the only certainty is that it's going to be a chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I've likened it back to, you know, during the 80s when they used to talk about nuclear fallout, the MAD, the Mutual Assured Destruction. This is Mutual Assured Destruction. This is saying, well, we can choose not to do it, but we're going to do it anyway, and we know what the outcome is going to be. But you know what? Look at those people over in Europe. Look at the austerity going on there. It's working so well.
Yeah, and the UK just got downgraded from its AAA rating.
Yeah.
Today. By
yeah.
Moody's. So that's how well that austerity is working out for them.
Again, you know, you just shake your head and go, what is it? Is it the petulant child? Is it the scorched earth? You know, is it my, I get, I'm going to take my ball and go, what is it they want? I blows my mind. Also, let's move into the cabinet. I understand Obama's got a controversial energy department pick.
He does have a controversial energy department pick. He's a brainiac,
uh-huh.
You know, and as the last one was a Nobel Prize winning scientist. This one's an MIT physicist. But the difficulty with him, Ernest Moniz, I think that's how you pronounce it. I could be getting the name wrong. Who's also, you know, guy about town in Washington, people know him, is that some green advocates don't like his support for natural gas because they think that that's at odds with the risks of fracking.
Yeah.
And the need for tough steps to address climate change. And they think he's much too lackadaisical on this issue and that he leans pro-fracking. And they're worried about this. There was also an MIT study done that seemed to be come out just a year ago that seemed to be pro-fracking. And they just think, you know, with him in charge, he is just not going to be going for alternative energy. He's
right.
Going to be going the easy route.
And so he should sail right through. I mean, the Republicans should be very happy with him, pro-fracking, and I'm sure, what's his stance on the big pipeline?
I think my understanding is that from everything that I've read actually nothing about what his stance is on the pipeline.
No pipeline. No pipeline stance. We're going to have to, I'm sure that may come up if the confirmation hearings.
Oh, yes, that'll come up.
Yeah, something along those lines. I wish we had the president, you know, has spent some money on alternative energy. I don't think enough. You know, fracking seems to be where we're going. I'm not in favor of it, but, you know, it's one of those things that it looks like the moneyed interests want it, and it looks like it's going to happen.
Yeah, it does look like it's going to happen. it freaks me out. I don't like seeing mountains with their tops blown off, and I don't like seeing, I don't like mountaintop mining, and I don't like seeing water go on fire.
Oh, come on, come on. If we could just flatten off Pennsylvania and West Virginia, you know, flatten off all those mountains, it would make it much better real estate.
It would be neater.
That's right. It would be flat.
Yes.
And I grew up in Ohio, where I lived, it was flat, and that was nice. Flat.
You see, it's like what Mitt Romney said about the trees all being the same height.
Exactly. See, I understood that.
I'm sure you did.
And he also said the magic screen, where you go into the Wawa and you push the screen and your sandwich just appears, like magic.
Oh, my God.
He could have been president. And I would have loved every minute of it, because he wouldn't be as good as George Bush, but I think he would still be good. Him and his bias full of women.
Oh, it would have been something.
Yeah, the country would have gone down the drain, but at least I would have had some material.
You would have had material every day.
And finally, Leon Panetta is giving the final drawdown numbers.
Yes, he is drawdown numbers. This is interesting. Basically, what he's saying, if I can find my piece of paper. Is that the final 32,000 barrel in Afghanistan. That's it.
Game over. And then we can use that money to do what?
Oh, well, you know, you want something sensible.
Tax breaks. Tax breaks.
Oh, tax breaks.
More tax breaks.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
More handout. We're going to encourage industry. Give Walmart some more money so that they can pretend like they're going to hire veterans.
There you go.
And have a really nice PR campaign around it. I'm still waiting for that. The numbers to come out on how many they actually hired. That nice PR moment, but I'm waiting for the numbers on that.
You don't think it's real?
I don't. the people coming back, will they take it for a short term? Maybe. I mean, I think the wages and there are no benefits. I just don't think that you're going to find people who are going to take those jobs. Or maybe they'll be desperate enough. You know, the economy isn't it growing as well as it should, and we're really not doing anything to encourage that. So maybe people will be desperate enough. From the people that I've talked to, I don't see it. But we shall see. So I'm waiting for the numbers. As always, Victoria, great talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
And you do as well. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things dark and cruel. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
After a large meteor exploded over Russia in February 2013, many were comparing the event to one that also happened in Russia a century before.
That earlier event happened on June 30, 1908, in a remote part of Russia. As in 2013, witnesses saw a fireball streak across the daytime sky. Within moments, something exploded in the atmosphere above Siberia's Tunguska River. The explosion released enough energy to kill reindeer and flatten trees for many kilometers around the blast site. This event is now widely known as the Tunguska event.
At the time, it was tough to reach this remote part of Siberia. It wasn't until 1927 that researchers made an expedition to investigate the Tunguska event. They interviewed witnesses and explored the region where the trees fell. There were no meteorite fragments and no sign of a crater.
Over the years, scientists and others concocted fabulous explanations of the Tunguska explosion, like the encounter of the Earth with an alien spacecraft, or a mini black hole, or a particle of antimatter.
The truth is much more ordinary. It's likely a small icy comet or stony asteroid collided with Earth's atmosphere on June 30, 1908. As in 2013, the object appears to have exploded in the atmosphere and caused a fearsome airburst above Russia. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on Earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Really? Yeah, well, that's the rhetoric, isn't it? It's always doomed. It's the end of the world. Do what we say or we will destroy you. Well, I guess we're buying it. Anyway, today in labor history, back in 1892, the Knights of Labor and the United Mine Workers met in St. Louis with 20 other organizations to plan the convention of the People's Party. They wanted to end political corruption. They wanted to make sure that there was wealth equality, and they wanted to end the oppression of workers' rights. Not only workers, but farmers as well. And again, you know, you go back to this and you go, what much different of a world would it have been had we stayed together and not been allowed to be divided in such a way? Good news in guns. I'm sure you'll be happy to hear Clarkstown, New York. 49-year-old guy was arrested. He was arraigned yesterday on charges of making terroristic threats, illegally possessing weapons, and harassment. Evidently, the guy's landlady happened upon his Facebook page where he had posted his hit list. He wanted to go after Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer, Cuomo, Nina Lowry, and all of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And a whole bunch of things, you know, said they were traitor scum, you know, they're all going to die, death to them all. When police went to his house, they found two high-powered rifles, two bayonets, a sword, a knuckle knife, body armor, and a bunch of ammunition. In fact, found 27 of what they call tank buster bullets, 50 caliber armor-piercing shells. I don't know what you would do with those. Hunting, I would assume. He was arraigned yesterday. Also, good news on guns in Detroit. Another guy with a hit list. This time a convicted felon and alleged neo-Nazi who had come up with about 40,000 rounds of ammunition. The 47-year-old guy wanted to go after the Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Detroit director and also the Detroit chapter of the NAACP's president. Had his little list as well. And according to NBC News, he was indicted in January of 13 on federal charges of possessing firearms, ammunition, and body armor, all of which violated his parole. He was released from prison in 2003 after 13 years being locked up in Ohio following a homicide there. They found 18 weapons. You know, shotguns, high caliber rifles, two AR-15s, and, like I said, 40,000 rounds of ammunition. Hey, you know, target shooting, right? The plastic bottles, going after the tin cans. And you'll be happy to know, in Montana, they are pushing a bill that would allow every person to carry a concealed weapon, because people who determine themselves qualified would be exempt from having to get an actual permit, and they could do it. Let them carry guns, because, you know, people are so much nicer when they got guns. And good news in Texas. Texas has decided that they will not allow their state troopers to shoot people from helicopters. So there you go. Today in guns. Isn't that a wonderful... Decided not to shoot people from helicopters. You know, just walking through the desert. Whatever you want to say about... on the border, I don't know that I like the idea of shooting them from helicopters. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone, and also paprogressivesummit.org. That's how you get to find out about the conference next Friday and Saturday, March 1st and 2nd. We'll see you.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like a tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial escape.